submitted to the public protector or the Directorate for Priority Crime Investigation established by Section 17C of the South African Police Service Act. And the relevant body must keep the Auditor General informed of proof and the final outcome of the investigation. If, Chair, I read the full effect of this, it is now attempting to deal with the issue of what happens to your audit report and the audit outcomes after you have reported. That's what we are proposing then as a fundamental shift in driving that level of accountability. And that's why we're saying this is one of the most prominent positionings and thinking that we have in the office, to say that if we arrive at a conclusion in a particular audit where, based on the evidence that the auditors have collected, have come to a conclusion that there is a possible abuse of funding of funds as evidenced by witnesses and persistent weaknesses in the systems of internal financial control, we are proposing that the Auditor General may refer any undesirable audit outcomes for investigation directly. So we will have a quantum of audit reports that have been issued for that particular year. This will allow us a space after we've signed these reports to analyze and scrutinize in detail every single one of those audits and select the most risky of them that point to possible financial abuse, because the limitation of an audit is that it is not able to come to a satisfactory, or rather to a conclusive conclusion on who is culpable in many other respects because of the sampling of transactions and all of that. So what this will allow will be a situation where those particular set of financial statements and issues are handed over to a body as articulated in this, with an appropriate accompanying budget, we hope, that will come from us to say, please go through these issues in detail and give us a report within a prescribed period of time as to the final outcome of the investigation, so that the appropriate mechanisms that will follow from there can easily be facilitated towards driving consequence around persistent financial administration deficiencies. In addition to this, we think, Chair, if we look at the first part where we say that we need to determine the policy regarding the nature and category of matters in respect of which an investigation or special audit could be performed, it will deal also with issues like your disclaimers of audit opinion. If an entity achieves a disclaimer of an opinion by the time we sign the financial statements at the 31st of July of every year, we are looking forward to a situation where the policy will provide us guidance to say within 30 days, for example, of that opinion being signed, that particular entity that achieved a disclaimer must be handed over compulsorily to an investigating agency to determine the extent to which the documentation that ought to have been surfaced in an audit has either been mislaid or deliberately suppressed. So these are the two categories of issues that we believe, from a preventative control mechanism, could begin to deal with some of the sticky issues that tend to find expression in places like SCOPA and so on. Because if 80% of the population that handles financial matters know that the risks of persisting deficiencies in the manner in which they handle finances are going to be high, it may well be a deterrent effect. Currently, they are low. The penalties are mild. Someone can get away with a 5 million transaction and get a fine of 26,000 rand. That's our reality. So the attempt here is to say that for as long as the risk is low, the penalties are mild, there will always continue to be maladministration if it is not handled through a mechanism like this. So among others, Chair, if you look at where we say, but not limited to, the public protector, if you look at an example of the public protector, it's already known that a matter that would be referred to that institution, once fully investigated and findings surfaced, it will carry a remedial action with it. So it kind of absolves us of having to worry about that part, because we might not be able to employ lawyers, whereas there's a state institution that's also available with that existing capacity that can facilitate that part and make sure that if there is a conclusion of wrongdoing, for example, on an institution that has got 25 million worth of irregular expenditure, they must know that once it hits the financial statements in terms of disclosure, it might be a candidate for selection for referral. And once it gets referred there, it will obviously attract the remedial action that is part of the mandate of that institution when the report is finalized. So the argument can only be between the person who is potentially the culprit and the court of law when they contest the validity of that remedial action. So it is matters like these that we are having in mind as we propose such an amendment. As I get closer to my 30 minutes.
Sorry, we can change it. You know, I'm just thinking, because we might lose some of these things, and these are very important matters. Should we not just deal with this one and deal with them chunk by chunk? Because otherwise I think we would lose it. This is a very important one, or two very important principles that are being proposed, and members might want clarity, might want to air their views, because ultimately we will sit down by ourselves and finalize it. So maybe let's just deal with this age, if you don't mind.
Yeah.
Be prepared to field questions of clarity if you will, I'll allow you,
yeah.
or to jot thinkings of members' views. We're not going to take decisions today, but we are brainstorming. So maybe just on these two that you've raised, if you can talk to them, then we'll allow members to engage.
Sure. happily, Chair. So, as I'm saying, these are kind of examples that we're looking at, because there's this experience of more than, I think, 15 to 20 years of the continuation of the same things that I had in the public domain, which never go away because the system relies on those that are charged with oversight to do something about it. And evidence is that they've either started doing something, but it amounted to nothing. Others have probably not even started. So we're trying to create that bridge here, which is a mandatory bridge that must be crossed at the end of any set of financial statements that have been issued. Because we know that, Chair, there are other people who have walked this journey before us, we've also borrowed some specific examples around how, in certain areas, matters like these are dealt with, where we looked at other jurisdictions, and I'm sure you've got some insight on them in terms of the documentation we sent you. But it is worth flagging just one element of it. In some jurisdictions, and perhaps I don't have to go to the detail of which, but it's in the continent here, Ghana to be specific, they even extend this to a point where they say, if the office of the chief procurement office knows that the bottle of water, wherever you are in the country, you get it for between 10 and 15 rand, regardless of what corner of the country you are, somewhere between 10 and 15, you get a bottle of still water. And if this is something that gets bought often at different places across all different parts of government, surely it will be an expectation that there's some base price that's available to determine within which range anyone can buy something like this. In those jurisdictions, if you have that, then you go away and do a supply chain process where you deviate from what is expected in Section 217 of the Constitution in terms of carrying out supply chain transactions. And you end up with this bottle at 55 rand. What they do, they issue what they call a surcharge certificate, which is the difference between 15 and 55. And the audit office there has got a mandatory authority to issue that surcharge certificate to that person or groups of persons that were involved in that supply chain management process. It becomes a debt. In France, they call it a debit, because they sit in front of the magistracy as part of the audit institution, and they issue a debit against the accounting officer. This is your debit for this financial year. Thank you very much for delivering unqualified financial statements here's your debit. In Ghana, they do the same. So the AG will sign those certificates of surcharge, which account for the difference of what could potentially be called a disposition with no value. Because the difference between a standard price of 15 rand for this, if you buy it for 55 and you circumvent supply chain management processes, you must know that you are creating a debit for yourself, regardless of how unqualified your financial statements may be at the end of the financial year. So this referral mechanism of these audit outcomes is not going to be something that is predetermined upfront. It will be determined by the outcomes and the qualitative interrogation of financial statements by the different teams who are responsible for this financial statement. So you cannot predict, however hard you try to correct your financial statements to be unqualified, if you still have these things that fall through the cracks in terms of supply chain, you might have to answer for a debate if that is what will evolve in the Act. So this issue about the AG has unqualified me sometimes just becomes a excuse to hide the fact that some are unqualified with significant findings in supply chain, as we all know, in terms of the final outcomes on audit reports. So that is the addition I wanted to make, Chair, and perhaps let me pause here.
All right, let's open it up to members for discussion, debate, critique. Honorable Singh.
Oh, thank you very much, Chairperson, and thank you for the presentation. And thank you for allowing us to hone in, because this certainly is the most important point of departure in the way the Office of the Auditor General is intended to operate moving forward. Chair, there's an example as well in Uganda. I think we were in Uganda, sitting with the mum's shopper was there, where they have the police actually sitting in the committee. And they have a list of all the transgressions and the amounts attached to the transgressions. And they actually showed us a register to say Director General owes X for that, Y for that, Z for that. And they have to pay. They have to pay. Now, one of the things is here, there's no consequences in our system. So we need to tighten up generally consequences. But, Chair, I want to start, before even going into this, you see, we place a lot of burden on the Office of the Auditor General. Things which should have been identified within departments with the help of National Treasury have now become things which chartered accountants have to look into in the Office of the Auditor General. And I don't believe we are using their expertise profitably and efficiently at the level of the Auditor General's office. And at some stage, I don't know if we have the power to do that, we need to invite National Treasury, as this committee, to find out what kind, you know, they talk about classes that they give people and schools and et cetera, et cetera. Because if we look at all your findings, most of your findings through your chair to the AG, are on basic financial record keeping, which it doesn't take a rocket scientist to make sure that you have an invoice, etc., let alone how much it costs. But that's what you are finding more than anything else. Now, that's the job of internal audit. That's the job of National Treasury, to empower departments and so on and so forth. So I'm just starting from that premise that, you know, we don't need to put more pressure and burden on this office when things should be done properly in the beginning. But I think the AG also mentioned a very important thing is, with all these amendments, I made a general comment here when I was reading this a few days ago, is the cost implications in terms of financial resources, infrastructure resources, because all of this is going to come with those consequences. Right. Now, coming specifically to this year, the special audit, you know, I agree that, you know, we need to take the 2017 and 2016 circumstances in our country, and what we read about in the newspaper and all these admissions really warrant more action to be taken internally, rather than us waiting for some whistleblower to say something somewhere, and then you refer it to the public protector or whatever, or ad hoc committee or a commission of inquiry, etc. Now, all I'd like to ask is, on the amendments here, is who will you say the Auditor General will refer undesirable audit outcomes. Is it done in consultation with any committee, political oversight, or is it taken as an independent decision to say, well, we feel that in this department something is not right and we are going to refer it as the Office of the Auditor General? I'm just talking about the political. Should there be political oversight in what you do at that stage of the game, or not? I'm asking aloud. Now, if a matter is referred to the SIU, normally the member of the executive goes through the president, SIU, etc. Public protector, anybody can do it. I can sit here and write to the public protector, and they would investigate. So I'm thinking about the how we do it so that there is no conflict of interest between the Office of the Auditor General and the department that you're investigating and so on. There needs to be a clear separation so that when we have an outcome, we can act on that outcome. Now, in Austria, I think you were there with us, Sikali, where we went to this corruption office. Mom Schopper, you remember. I think we need to look at that, Chair. They had a whole office called, it was called an anti-corruption office. I forget the exact name of it, but we visited there. And they gave us a full briefing, as this committee, full briefing on this office and what it does. Should we not be looking at something like that, a unit, a special unit, that would deal with all these matters that emerge from you, rather than just only public protector or SIU? So that's something that we can look at. And then, after the investigation is completed, let's say the PP or the SIU, what happens to that investigation? What is the line of command? Does it come back to SCOPA? Does it go back to the department? Because some parliament will have to act against that department in some way or the other. Like we get a PP report which says we must take action as parliament or whatever. So I'm just trying to look at the chain that we have to follow. But I think in the 2017 circumstances, this should have been done many years ago where we've had these teeth to deal with some of these transgressors. Because up to now, very few, if any, are punished for any wrongdoing in the financial sector. Thank you,
sir. Thank you, Chairperson. I think I am fully in support of the proposed amendments, all of them. They are necessary. We have got 23 years behind us, and the Auditor General from AG Fagan, there is no improvement. And I can't believe that people are ignorant. For 20 years, I don't believe. And I think people who are employed in departments, the chief financial officers, these people are usually qualified people. And I think there is no willingness to improve because there is no consequence. And the suggestion, the proposed amendments, I think would actually assist us. I think that you call it the debate. It should have been instituted 10 years ago. We wouldn't be sitting where we are. Today we have got a situation where we have no growth. And unless we are serious and tighten the screws, all the loose screws, we're going to find ourselves unable to run this country. I just want to remind Honorable, I think the Uganda one is also good, but I like the one that is suggested by the AG. The Austria one, where we went, It was an institution. They say it's an institution where you are trained, because I actually asked Masuta, can't I be a student there? And it was left hanging. It was not an institution where they They have they investigate. They actually train people. They say your country has must be a member of that of some agreement. Of but if your country is not a member, I think it's quite difficult to be part of that. I think I still have a book. I'll give it to the chair to look at. But it is not an oversight body. It's a training institution, the Institute of Anti-Corruption Institute, if I remember very well.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, I would like to go to page 3, section 4. For me, I understand this insertion being very important, but also as you go down from the 1, 2, 3, 4, number 4, the sentence number 4, where it says, following below a threshold determined by the Auditor General. Chair, I was going to propose that if we're saying falling below a threshold, we are more general. We're still not giving proper powers because if you look at Chapter 12 of the PFMAA, those schedule, those entities that you're supposed to audit, which are so many. Now, why are we not being direct, taking into consideration that us as the committee, we always saying there are municipalities which are failing to generate revenue. As a result, they are owing us, the Auditor General, for years, and they are not going to be able to pay because they are not generating the revenue. Now, why don't we say, instead of saying falling below a threshold, you become specific that you put the PFMA somewhere there. Whether I'm not a legal person, but you'll get a better one, or whether you say the major public entities, but you have to use it, so that then, section 4, clause 4, then become relevant when we say in the event of any conflict. Now the conflict now comes where that municipality submit to the Auditor General and say, but we do not have the revenues. That's a conflict, right? But that conflict, you must be able to provide there on top, on 3A, because that is a constitutional function of the Auditor General. So it will need a two-thirds majority to change that in the House. So I am saying there is a falling below a threshold. You apply the section, the Chapter 12 of the PFMA. You'll see how you apply it, but bear in mind what you keep on saying us as the committee, that you come to Bulwa, my municipality, there is nothing there, nobody's paying the what services for water, the rates and taxes. So if you can just do that, and then once you have done that, I'm sure you can email it to church. She will give it to us, that how did you change that clause. It makes me a bit uncomfortable. And then you go to page 4, Roman figure 3, under A. I'm sure it's a mistake of that close sign there. I don't know what is it. I think it's just a mistake, Auditor General. Maybe we need to delete that because I don't understand. Otherwise, I agree with the insertion of the provide on both B and the C. But you have to remove those clauses because I don't understand what does, unless you have got a reason why they were there. You see, when you read clause, Roman figure 3, that now there under A, there's 10, then clause 1, clause B, then there's something standing next to it. Okay. Then you go to page 5, which is the new matters altogether, which are being proposed by the Auditor General. I don't have a problem with them, but as you read, that's exactly what the auditor was saying, giving us an example of procurement. And for me, you still don't have the power, irrespective that you have done that. Unless we say after clause F, where you say on condition that dash, Roman figure one, prior approval of the oversight mechanism is obtained, good. But now we need to have following that quickly. Then we've got Roman two, where we say, because it has to flow based on the audit on those audit outcomes, where it has indicated a non-compliance of any applicable legislation relating to financial matters, a such a certificate will be issued. It's a new thing. I'm proposing that so that there's going to be a flow that. This is what you have said in the section 5, clause E. This is what you are saying, and then you are saying or, based on that, and then you are saying you have that mechanism. But now, failing to do so, there is some non-compliance. So what are you going to do? You have to. We must say you have to give some such a, before you even go to the before you even go to your colleague, the public protector. So if you do that, then we come down to the public protector. Clause B of section 5(1A). Instead of saying determine a policy, why don't you say determine a regulation? Because a regulation is stronger than a policy. You have to determine a regulation, not a policy, right? And then, Auditor General replied to me because I was going to say, why can't you do the remedial action? He told me it doesn't have the personnel, so it doesn't have money to employ people. I was going to insert that remedial, so I'm not going to insert anything. Other than that, then that becomes okay on the Section 5 for me. I don't have anything. I am happy, Chairperson. I think all the proposal, I agree with them, but with what I've just amended on those proposals, I think.
Okay. As members suggest amendments or strengthening, it helps if you also write it down. AG will allow you to comment on them, initially. But if members have them, so that we can circulate them to each other, so that even amongst ourselves we debate everybody else's proposal, so that we don't waste too much time when we get to it. Mente and then Mpanza.
Thanks, Chair. Thank you very much, Auditor General. I appreciate the work that you have done and the extent in which you've gone through. But there is something that's been troubling me, like the technicalities that are used in law. Let me make an example that the ACTT, which now investigate corruption, starts at 5 million up, and then there is a tendency that anything that's below that is something that it can be ignored. And now I'm looking at the undesirable audit outcome and the technicality that it carries in terms of law. I don't know whether is it because you are doing it for the document, or can you go to an extent where you at least prescribe what is an undesirable audit outcome? Because a new method now of corruption is inflating prices, like you were making an example of the bottle of water. That's the new way now that the money is going out of departments, where things are bought for like extremely, extremely high prices. So if you can just explain the undesirable outcome, what exactly is that? So that the departments, when they want to tackle you in terms of law, they do not come to say, we didn't actually know, it's not an undesirable outcome. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. Yes, one on page 2, I also support, I've studied the bill quite a lot, and I also support the proposals. Okay. So what I'm saying, Chair, also on the issue of the refer undesirable audit outcomes. I think that one on page 2. It's a good one, but I also wanted to talk on the issue of ensuring that there is no conflict with other arms of government when we deal with that one. But also I want to check how is this also this amendment talking to other legislation that might be also having a bearing in this. One of them, the Public Finance Management Act, and also the Municipal Finance Management Act. So I'm just checking that when this proposal were made, did they also look at some legislation that might have also, because you don't want to amend something or propose something, but then you are also actually undoing what is already in the other legislation that is also have to do with all these issues that we are dealing with. Thank you, Chair.
Honourable Ntombela, followed by Honourable Topham.
May I also take this opportunity to express my appreciation for the report. I just needed to be clarified here that as a preventive control mechanism, does the Auditor General consider the frequency or rather the consistency of a particular department's behavior or performance? We usually talk about the serial offenders. At which point would the AG say this person qualifies for this kind of an action in terms of our investigations or whether it has to be investigated at all? Because I taking into consideration the gravity of the offense or the gravity of the problems that are in that particular unit. Chair, I just wanted also to check the definition of the irregularities. Would it be taken into consideration as to when we talk about irregularities in a particular department, are they going to be consistent in terms of their definition so that warrants a particular action as part of strengthening the AXA. Chair, subject to correction, I was under the impression that the Auditor General is a Chapter 9 institution. Then why are the recommendations of a Chapter 9 institution not binding, like those of the Public Protector? It just comes to my mind. Maybe one would, as a way of positioning itself, the Office of the Auditor General, as part of the bodies that are proactive in trying to deal with the situation that in which we find ourselves, maybe that should be considered as well. And then, I think I'll put it at that, Chair. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I also would like a little bit of clarity of the concept of undesirable audit outcomes. On the point of view, let's presume, obviously in the various acts, the accounting officer has a responsibility to take further action very often, for instance, to report something for prosecution, some unlawful expenditure or something like that. And if they failed to do so, that would then become an undesirable audit outcome, I would presume. Or would it also, would it include, for instance, coming across a suspect pricing practice or something like that? And would it go as far as if there is a clear-cut issue of there seems to have been some loss to the entity in question, would the word refer be enough to enable you to actually lodge a charge as such, not a charge, a open up a docket with the police, or is a refer just allowing them to go and look, investigate it further themselves, and then somebody will later have to go and actually lay the charge? And then on, as far as mandate is concerned, some of these matters could be quite complex. And would this allow, it doesn't allow you the possibility yourself to investigate a matter further beyond the scope of general audit of the financials. Would you require that type of power to actually investigate a matter more on a forensic-like nature to give a more comprehensive set of information to the to one of these authorities? Because they don't have the in-house capabilities very often to do that. Or would that rather then be the scope of a separate engagement with the entity that you were the auditor of?
Anybody else wants to proffer some suggestions? I want to be the last, otherwise I will go. Anybody else wants to say something? No? All right. AG, just two or three things. Let me follow up on what most of my colleagues are saying. This term that you're using of undesirable audit outcomes. Now, I'm sure Honorable Mente and even Singh and others will bear with me. You know, I think you need to further elaborate on undesirable. And I'm using it in the sense of, you know, people would come and say, but it's not fruitful and wasteful, it's irregular. And yet we know it's not irregular. I mean, he just didn't get a tax certificate or he did what you were doing. And then they would come and say, but the accounting officer is going to condone it later on. In my book, it's an undesirable audit outcome if you pay 55 rand for something that you paid 10 rand for. So I think that term undesirable outcome, we have to link. I mean, I'm speaking for myself. I understand where there's irregular expenditure because it was unforeseen, a fire in Neisner, and you didn't get three coats. But many of these irregular expenditures are because of poor planning. Now, I don't know how we're going to further distill this thing that is called irregular. And I'm saying it because irregular gives a backdoor exit of condoning. And I'm saying we must think about it, SCOPA must think about it, Parliament must think about it. 48 million of irregular expenditure. If I was the AG, if I was somebody else, you'd probably find 1 billion is irregular because it was unforeseen. The rest is downright fraud and corruption. So that undesirable, AG, when you go away, you must think about it. We must think about it. The second one, AG, is you know, you're saying there that you will refer matters that you have identified to the public protector and other agencies. Now, have we thought about this practice that is creeping in where auditees challenge your findings? You might think that, well, from where I'm sitting, this thing is undesirable or whatever. And yet, more and more we find departments saying, but I'm challenging your findings as the AG. So what will the deadlock-breaking mechanism be? Because you might say it's undesirable, you want to send it to the public protector. The department or entity says, no, AG, you didn't understand our business. So what is the deadlock-breaking mechanism, or how do we deal with it? Who eventually decides that we support the AG's version or we support the department's version? And then the third one, AG, maybe I was not listening or concentrating. Somewhere you said you need a policy to further investigate because it's difficult when you sit and decide, should I take this thing further and so on. If you could just elaborate on what is this difficulty that you find when you say that, up to now anyway, it was difficult to do it. And then my final point, AG, because I think this will come up, and you alluded to it. Are you going to be accused of being the investigating officer, the prosecutor, and all those type of things? Because you did the initial audit, and then you're going to be referring it to the public protector. I would imagine the public protector is going to be saying, well, come and substantiate your point. So I'm just saying those investigating, prosecuting, when it eventually gets to the public protector, because I can assure you when it gets to some of these institutions, they will turn around and say, we do not have the capacity that the AG has. You know, in the arms deal, we had this combined thing for that very reason. We had you as the AG, we had the public protector, and I think it was the SIU or somebody, but we had a tricameral type of investigation. Now, if you refer it to the public protector and he or she turns around and says, but I don't have the skills, what then do we do? Do we do to break it? And then the final point is I agree 100% with all these things, honorable members, because, again, honorable Mente will agree with me that you get a department AG that you have found to have had undesirable audit outcomes. And when they come here, they've been investigating for the past 5 years. It's pending. 5 years, pending. So that's why I'm saying I'm agreeing with this, that we have to close this gap where people can just, since 2012, have an investigation about whether Topham did the right thing or did the wrong thing, and it's pending for 10 years. So I agree with the general direction. I just think that maybe taking into consideration what members are saying, it must become clear to everybody. You do this, you're out of order. You do this, Parliament has the authority. You do that, Public Protector has the authority. So those are the general feelings around these two. If you could comment on them, and then members can go on to maybe the next two if there are. You want to just on these ones?
Yes. Thank you. Sorry to come after you, Chair. I just want to comment on what you have said of departments challenging the findings of the Auditor General and giving excuses like, you didn't understand us. I think we must be strict on that, because my understanding is that there is correspondence between the AG and the ODT called management letters, and that gives space for people to explain and to the Auditor General what they think he did not understand. But for people to come up after having been audited and say, no, he did not understand us, no, it is because that book was there or that invoice was there, but it was somewhere, I think that is just delaying us. We have had 23 years of things not going right, and we need to put down our foot.
Thank you, Chair. We'll try and cover a couple of the points that the honorable members have raised. And perhaps if I may just start with the one on undesirable audit outcomes. You know, when I think about this, Chair, obviously we didn't want to have a list, because there can never be one that's exhaustive, because circumstances over time change. But it reminded me, Chair, that generally, maybe 80% of us know what is desirable. And it's almost like when somebody asks about the kind of synonyms that describe integrity. You'll hear people talk about the likes of honesty, principle, virtue, goodness, morality. All of those things, they are the basket of things that could fit into a definition of integrity. The likes of probity are part of that family, trustworthiness, truthfulness. So I'm sure as you think about integrity and I say these words, you start understanding fully what sort of things fit into the realm of integrity. Unlike the antonyms to integrity, which could be corruption, duplicity, deceit, disrepute, all of those things. So we are in that space when it comes to undesirable audit outcomes. So we've got to think in line with the thinking that the members have shared with us. Because we know from history how many and what is the quantum, what areas we do. We know that when somebody has a disclaimer and they make a commitment this year that they are going to make sure that they put on the table all the required documents to substantiate transactions, and then they don't do it the following year. And then again, they don't do it. They still end up with a disclaimer because they know that the hurdle for consequence is quite low. So obviously that will definitely fall into that category of outcomes. But it's got to be a combination of things, almost like a mixed bag of things that, as I said now, in terms of the different things that describe integrity. So we'll do that work, no doubt about it. But I think once we've understood what the desirable type of outcomes are, we can be able to filter through our experience, through what is written in the law, in respect of regulations that account for certain types of transactions, that we will be able to feed into. But I think we'll be reticent to produce an exhaustive list because you also want to bring an element of surprise here. So extending the independence of the institution, as I said, it is probably worthy so that there is no undue interference to allow, coming back to your question, Honorable Singh, at the beginning. It will be appropriate to allow the audit institution to independently apply itself in respect of the insights that have been obtained in an audit. Because when we do the final evaluation of audit outcomes, we do have conversations with our teams where we interrogate at a deeper level. What did you observe while you were auditing? Rather than what you wrote in your report as a consequence of the audit. So some of those things do come to light, so you cannot prescribe them as an exhaustive list up front. But I think we can make a start and say typically continuing disclaimers, persistent deviations from supply chain on the basis of emergency. Surely if you've got a supplier with a contract and you've got multiple emergencies about stuff that you do every year, surely there's got to be something undesirable about that behavior. If one looks at what the supply chain regulations prescribe. It could have been emergency at the beginning, but the subsequent transactioning around the same particular issue, what makes it so urgent every day? Because now if the first point was an emergency, surely subsequent actions around that transaction ought not to be an emergency as well, unless planning, as we said, is not in place. Then again, if you go through a deeper root cause analysis, we also want to understand why is there no planning? Because surely this thing about not having planning is a bit suspect because it may just be a deliberate attempt to not have the planning to do the things that you ought to have done in order to get the outcome that you expect. So it's as complex as a mixed bag like that. So that when we start saying, no, it's because they can't plan, then we ask another why. And another why, and another one, until we get to the real essence of what this thing is about. Now, the experience that we have currently is that much as these things get ventilated at the levels of scoper interaction and all that, they normally happen pre-investigation. So what we are putting on the table here is that I'm the accounting officer. I've been presented a report at the end of July. Like it happened at SABC the other day, I might make a reference to it. When they were appearing before Scopa, the acting CFO, who was sitting right here, said this year, when the financial statements are finished, they will be handed over to the Auditor General on 31 May. And then the financial statements of SABC will be audited and an audit report will surface on 31 July. That's what the acting CFO said. Then, after we receive the financial statements, we will then trigger a process of investigations that will ultimately result in
consequences subsequent to the end of July. That's on tape. I listened to it as an interaction at COPA. So that's the mechanism that could work if it were to be dealt with diligently. Because it means that an institution that has got the necessary technical tools to identify the realm of issues, whether they are to do with maintaining accounting records, because accounting records are another troubled area where accounting records are not maintained, because if they're not maintained, it's easy to hide the things that you don't want to be seen because there's no proper oversight over those accounting records. If you make it your reality not to have a CFO on board for some 9 months consistently without due explanation, who is supposed to be providing that control with regards to managing the finances of the institution? It could be that matter. Why is this institution sitting comfortably for the last 2 years without a CFO? It may well be that the reason these accounting records are so unreliable is because it serves another purpose. So the quantum of undesirable outcomes, Chair, as our teams audit, if you look at all of them across the 9 provinces, we've obviously got to gear up in terms of our methodology to say that as you audit, make sure that this is not a witch hunt exercise. It's an exercise that is attempting to bridge the accountability gap. So make sure that if there's persistent issues of deviation from supply chain, you make note of them, because at the evaluation stage of those audits, we are going to have to sift out some of those elements that point to persistent elements that potentially could, because you are still at a level of no conclusive yet, because you are expressing an opinion on an audit. By taking that list, let's say, of 20, if it ends up being a list of 20 different items at different institutions in different provinces in the PFMA, and we say, here's a list of 20 items that we believe are a priority for further investigation. Once they go through that process of investigating them, the real reasons that will absolve or recommend further action will surface, because currently they don't. We always are at the beck and call of those that are charged with governance to do something about it, and little happens. So in looking at the comments raised, therefore, as far as issues of the additional costs, again, Honorable Singh, we are keen to limit the extent of the financial obligation for this, because as far as the instrument that results in this schedule, if I have a picture of it, it may list the name of the entity, the province where it is, the nature of the items picked up during the audit, and substantive documentation to support our inconclusive discomforts, as it were, with those items. We would not want to do additional work on it, other than to say, part of the request for our appropriation, if we have to trigger an appropriation for this purpose, would be a limited quantum of resources that will be at our disposal, so that when we do the referral, the other institution does not say, I don't have the money to put together the people who will do this investigation. We'll say we'll fund it, because we would have generated the resources for it, and we'll actually hold you to account and say that it is prescribed that once we hand over these matters to you, they've got to report it back to us by whatever the prescribed date is. It is then our responsibility to make sure that we process those matters to the relevant decision makers who have to act on them. So that's the situation we are envisaging as far as taking the matter forward, as you asked. So in the decision making and in the evaluation of which items, we certainly do not seek an additional level of oversight on the political side, because what we are trying to do here is to extend our ability to take the audit conclusion to the next level. And we hope that the system will trust our capacity to do that with the level of transparency, with the level of discipline. Hence the policy that we say must be elevated, so that whoever is in the institution in the future knows that after you've signed off on audit reports, there's a policy that prescribes that a team of the executives, together with the key people running these audits, will sit down and evaluate based on audit evidence gathered at that point up to the reporting on the financial statements to assess the eligibility of certain items, stroke institutions that require the transactions that have been inspected through the audit to be further examined. So it does not become a limiting factor for anybody else who may have an idea about another transaction that this team may not have picked as an example. So it's part of saying you can do all that you do. We don't have a list up front of who and what will be handed over. It will be determined in an open engagement by the team at the AG who will hold each other to account as they have done up to now. An example, I think, members of perhaps some of the strengths that we are talking about. For all those audit opinions that we sign in the office, even me, I do not have the authority to tell somebody to change that opinion if they proposed it in their team as the opinion to be expressed on financial statements. Because we want to make sure that people exercise their professional judgment. We know that they can make mistakes, but we've got sufficient internal control disciplines to minimize those. So that's where I said we do have the capacity to assess these items based on a number of studies that we have done, including our own investigations business unit, who is currently involved even now in strengthening the hand of our external auditors in terms of sharpening their ability to identify issues that are potentially vulnerable to financial and system abuse. So it will be a detailed exercise on our side. We would also need to work on to make sure that the mechanism behind this is such that if anybody were to question it, it would be a case of anybody else with similar information and technical capacity would potentially have come to a similar decision. I think that would be the test for us to say that would someone else with all the available information through the audits as well as the insights of the people who are involved in the audits, would they have made a different decision if they had access to information of a similar kind? So that's why we are thinking that a principal approach that is aimed at narrowing the space for the 80% that normally think that they can do what they want in the system because the laws are weak and the rules are sometimes deviated from without consequence. So that's the effort here. Because we think that the other 10% never worry about this thing if you look at the realm of distribution of people. But there are those in the 10% aisle at the bottom who will take anything just because they want to. So this is perhaps an intervention that is aimed largely at that. But again, Chair, looking at the suggestion also about a possible special unit rather than handing over to the PAP or the SIU. Well, it may come with its own costs, but I think it's a thinking in the right direction. If I hear Honorable Singh, it's possibly talking about a special integrity unit, which perhaps is a relevant thing to think about because a combination of those efforts will be helpful in looking at a matter of this nature. For as long as we know that if I touch a 25 billion budget for whatever purpose, there's a couple of steps that will follow to ensure that probity and transparency is achieved. Right. Mam Tubazana, I picked up on the matters you've raised with due consideration. I think the issues pertaining to the falling below a threshold. I'll ask Marisa at some point, who's here in the team, to also help us in just explaining the link in that, but we'll attend to the points that you have raised in terms of further engaging that aspect in our proposal. Honorable Mente, the issue, I guess, of undesirable outcomes and legal technicalities, we'll scrutinize that area, as I said earlier on, to make sure that, as we put it out here, because we wanted to find a decent word to use just to put in the Amendment Act, and I think somebody gives somebody money to do things in the eyes of that who gives the money to the other. What could come top of mind as undesirable, considering that you have outlined the levels of accountability for what must be done with that money?
And I think we'll try and tread carefully in making sure that we highlight the issues at a principal level, but provide sufficient examples to demonstrate what we're talking about as far as this is concerned. But the legal teams are available to help us make sure that we deal with this properly. I think it's worth noting also that short of having a list of the type of things that could end up in this referral list, we like the surprise element. So that it cannot be predicted with certainty that when this audit comes next year, it's going to interrogate revenue. And then people rest for the rest of the year for other things because they think the audit strategy is just on revenue. So they come up with all these predictive tricks to try and throw things in front of you because they think yours is just to see the words and the signature and move on. We've now deepened the level of scrutiny to make sure that we don't get confused unnecessarily. Again, Honorable Mbanza, the matter you raised around the undesirable audit outcomes and ensuring there's no conflict with other arms, certainly we'll take it on board. I think we do recognize the need to explain further that matter, as well as the other legislative instruments. I think if one looks at the PFMA and the MFMA, largely it prescribes how people ought to conduct themselves when it comes to matters financial. Whereas our proposal here is about how do we stretch our ability to exercise the hand of oversight over those disciplines. So there's unlikely to be a conflict with them, but we'll double check, and I'm sure the team has had a check on it. Because they prescribe different situations. The one is to say to accounting officers in Section 38, make sure that when there are instances of irregular expenditure, you prevent them, and when they happen, you report them. Like the point the chair raised. Fires in Nizna. Nobody will fault anyone who goes and do what they need to do to replace the situation to a normal condition there. So those are the issues, I think, that will be taken into account. And, of course, an audit, Chair, if one looks at it, is inherently a contested space, just by its very nature. It is a contested space. We never walk away from any of these audits having not busted the gut, if I might put it like that. We often pass the gut by the time we get to a final conclusion, because we know that an audit, in order for it to be successful, there's got to be an active auditor and an active auditee. Other people, they stretch that beyond the reasonable levels. And I think contestations we'll always find, and I think we've got a mechanism now to make sure that we deal with them. And of course, if they are not concluded, we've got mechanisms to try and facilitate clearance of those matters. So the point is, at the point when we have to exercise the referral, hopefully, for the reasonable issues that normally arise in an audit that require ventilation between an auditor and an auditee, those matters would have been dispensed with by that time. Should there be remaining matters beyond, as it happens in some other situations even now, we exercise the standards that are required of auditors to deal with that matter. And one of them is to say, well, because of the persistence of your issues in light of the evidence that we have, the only thing we just don't do, we just don't sign your financial statements, which is not the ideal situation, because the only way we evidence our agreement is by signing them. So our assumption has always been that if a set of financial statements with an audit report has been signed, sometimes the accounting officer has had to bite the bullet. There are those issues. I think an audit is difficult by its nature, as I say. But we learn through this. We're not hoping that we will put out a list if we go ahead with this of 150. No. Maybe a list of 5 for as long as somebody's going to do something about it. Then it will shift in some way the way things are done by those that are watching the instrument taking shape over time. So even as far as the resources are concerned, it will be trying to complement other efforts that are there, because there's nothing we cannot ignore the fact that there is still a need to increase the capacity of people who may be improving their performance in government. That's a job, as we said, as Honorable Singh said, for the likes of National Treasury to continue to do that, to continue to increase the capacity and the training, because there's a developmental side to this, but somewhat there's also evidence of something that is not so developmental about the challenges, but it's something to do with the fact that consequences are low. Does AG consider, Honorable Ntombela, the frequency and consistency of behavior? I think those things will come into the picture. As I said, consistent outcomes that are pointing to disclaimers, meaning that we do not have sufficient evidence to express an opinion, and the frequency of those, including the frequency of financial statements having to be subjected to a number of adjustments, despite the fact that the finance department has got a full complement on board. Issues pertaining to ongoing supply chain purchases where deviations are the order of the day. So it will point to, among others, in terms of the criteria and how we will evolve the policy, it will incorporate issues of frequency and consistency of those undesirable outcomes once we have defined and detailed them. The definition of irregularities, there's too many irregularities, I think. I think if one uses an 80-20 rule, the fact that you did not appropriately report the delivery of your services insofar as water in a particular municipality is concerned may be just an area for people to worry about as they improve their systems, but it's not something that one would want to subject to a referral of that particular matter. So you may fail the audit on account of not reporting accurately on your performance unless, as we dig deeper, we find that perhaps the reason not performing is because you don't want to match the money spent to the things done. And there's some evidence that's showing there. Unlike somebody who slips up on reporting kiloliters and reports something else which is not consistent with their plan. So those will be the things that we will go through in detail to say, what is the possibility that there could be potential financial risk in a matter of this nature? And that's how we will be applying ourselves to come to a filtered outcome of issues that we will present without fear, favor, or prejudice. Then the option, as you raised it, Honorable Topham, I think you have answered some of your points regarding undesirable outcomes as well as the commitment that we are making to deal with that matter further. However, I think you also raised a matter pertaining to whether we would consider doing this ourselves, this investigation part of ourselves. We thought about it very carefully, Chair, this issue, and are of the view that let's separate issues so that we can deal with the potential for someone to see us as the investigator, the prosecutor, and everything else. Let's separate the issues. Ours is an audit mandate to audit and to report. But you are closing the loop in that chain of reporting. That's all we're doing. We do not want to suddenly find ourselves having to set up a department which will be too costly to start with. Whereas there may be capacity in a combination of institutions, not only the two we've mentioned, we said any other, where we can say we've got these four or five cases, we'll sit down with you and have a thorough briefing on the issues that concern us as far as the issues pertaining to the outcomes and the transactions that are concerned. Are you able to do this within the prescribed period of time that we have set out? Because if you're looking for documentation and other support, we will avail it. So it's an attempt for us to minimize the cost implication, but to give it to people who will have the appropriate tools. Because for an audit institution geared with the way that we are, sometimes the investigations business unit is dependent on who brings a request for an investigation. It's not necessarily something that we generate. So it can be idle money that is being spent on people who do not have much to do, whereas some of these institutions, their bread and butter is to employ a combination of information technology auditors, information investigation experts, and all of those things who can deploy their resources knowing that there is enough resource to pay for it. All we want to get to is, after this outcome has been done, the actions that ought to follow by those charged with governance. And that's why we don't want to have this, but at least if we can have a defined set of resources, we know that for something like this that we have put on the table, it's more than likely that it's going to be this period of time, and these are the rates. We can predetermine and manage the fiscal considerations in that context. Right, then I see undesirable audit outcomes in all the inputs, and I hope I have dealt with all of them.
the policy to further investigations where, Chair, you require some elaboration on this. The difficulty, Chair, that we are highlighting here is that when people come to Parliament and then they hear something that has to do with money, whatever it is, whichever part of the world it comes from, then they take the mic and then they say they are going to ask the Auditor General to investigate. And then they send us the letter, some of them, to request us to investigate. So when we evaluate the matters, we always come to some conclusion that this matter is probably not worth our effort in the sense that we are busy in this particular institution currently doing an audit. Now, there's an audit team from the Auditor General busy auditing statutorily the financial statements, sitting with the CFO and all of the relative executives in that particular institution. And then 3 days later, arrives a team of investigators also from the Auditor General speaking to the accounting officer about an investigation that they are required to come and do. That's where the conundrum comes in for us. It does cause unnecessary deviation, even in terms of conduct, around the issues of the statutory audit that we have to deal with. Because this one about the investigation has got its own complexities in terms of how you interact as an investigator and an investigatee versus an auditor and an auditee of the same institution, as it were. So we're trying to manage that situation so that we don't find ourselves having to investigate things that we are pronouncing on in the audits, as it were, because it causes difficulty. It causes difficulty. Somebody's going to turn around and say, but you were auditing this set of accounts. Little do they know that the scope of work for an audit is based on a selection of samples based on your assessment of risk, whereas the scope of an investigation is to go where it will stay, if I may put it like that. Because you're going to have to ask for all sorts of things and interview all sorts of people in the same context as you are busy doing an audit. So we always prefer that let another institution rather do the investigation, because they will come with an independent set of perspectives to that environment without spoiling the effort of a mandatory statutory effort anyway. We were recently asking the one institution and one of the state-owned entities to do that, and we said we're currently completing our audit exercise for this year. It is inconceivable that we could run parallel an investigation of the nature that you describe, because some of those things are also outside of the minimum competences required to be able to conduct a successful investigation exercise. So that's why we would like to make sure that the policy elevates this clarity, to make sure that when we do embark on certain specific investigations, for example in supply chain, we guide it by that particular policy, so that we do not find ourselves in conflicting situations where there's a big report coming out of the same institution from the same people who were conducting the audit effort. It's just to manage that particular potential risk, because those things come in a lot more, Chair, and we don't fault the people who raise them, because sometimes when you hear big numbers, the first thing you think about is it's possible that the AG can assist with it. But what we do now when we receive them, we write a response to those people who write to us and recommend that a matter like this, where there are issues of employment, deviations and those type of things, it will be best if you took it to the Office of the Public Service Commission, who are the ones responsible for those type of issues, or the Human Rights Commission, or any one of those. So that's how we are handling it now, so that we don't make them feel that we are not wanting to respond to their request, but we direct them where they can get best served. I don't know, Chair, maybe Marissa, do you want to quickly help with that part, or the one I referred to regarding the explanation of the link for Section 43A and Section 5, the points that Honorable Tobazana raised, if you can just tackle that briefly, please.
The AG, if there's anything else I left, I'm sure you will come in and help in providing any additional insight in here, but let's give you first, and then Marissa will come on.
Thank you very much, AG. I think you've responded to the various questions that were raised, so I'm not sure that there's anything I need to add at this point, unless there is a specific question that members would like to ask.
Thank you very much. Marissa?
Thank you, IG, Chair, and members. I actually very much welcome the question about the thresholds, because I personally worked on this matter. And maybe just for some background, how this proposed amendment ended up in the bill. The Auditor General receives many requests these days for an opt-in audit on certain state-owned entities. For example, the SIA that we recently took over. Now, these are very, very big audits that put a lot of pressure on the resources of the Auditor General. And when the opportunity then came up to relook at the bill, we decided, let's look at the entire audit portfolio that the Auditor General is responsible for. There are in this portfolio quite a number of very, very small audities. You're looking at a trust fund here, a board there, a museum. For example, a language museum where you sit with an annual turnover of 2 million rand. Almost the entire set of financial statements is made up of salaries. Let's say about 70% of that is just salary. And you look at what the Auditor General does, the kind of audit that he performs, and he provides a reasonable assurance on those financial statements. So there's a lot of effort that goes into auditing that particular small museum. And because in Section 20 of the PAA we require a reasonable assurance engagement, there's a whole suite of audit procedures that we perform there. We can also not really recover from a small entity that kind of effort that we put in there. So the thinking behind this one was, let's see how the Auditor General can strategically focus his attention on those very high-risk audits, where we literally talk about millions, billions of state resources, and focus the efforts there. Because if you look at these small entities, they've obviously come with a history of clean audits. A small museum, there's actually nothing to audit. So the risk is low as well. So the thinking behind this section is to maybe make them opt-out audits. And we can do this in many ways. And the criteria that one can look at here, if we talk about the term threshold, it's not only a monetary threshold. You look at the annual turnover, that's but one of the criteria. The second one can be a history of performance of that particular auditee. Let's say for the past 10 years there were clean audits, no significant findings, etc. So you look at the overall risk there as well. And how we will do that is then to perhaps look at revising, and you will see that also in Section 20, amending Section 20 to also allow for a review as opposed to a full audit. And a review can be certain, it's a limited assurance, it's less procedures that you have to perform there, but there is some form of assurance that there is still, it's just limited. The other way of looking at it is perhaps to not do it every year. But if there's a history of clean audits, let's say every 3 years, the Auditor General goes back and he relooks the picture there. Is it still a clean environment? So maybe we can relook, honourable member, the term threshold, because maybe this term creates the impression that this is a monetary threshold. And we can perhaps consider something like a particular auditee that meets certain criteria as determined by the Auditor General. So let's take that back and relook at the terminology used, because the intention is not to talk about monetary only. I was in the SCOPA session where, Honourable Chair, I saw you as well on the 16th of May. We looked at the very low, it seems, 5 million every year, 5 million there, but if you add it all up into one bucket, there's a lot of money that gets lost, and we can actually use that for service delivery. So let's look at the terminology here, but that was the thinking behind it. I don't know if that sufficiently answers the question.
You want to another bite? No. All right. Honorable Singh, and then we'll move on to the others. Remember, I mean, the others are very simple. This was the major one. We'll still have to comment on the proposal of the establishment of the audit committee or the change thereto, the remunerations committee, international exposure. But this one was really the meat. So members want a second bite. I don't have a problem. And as you have your second bite on this one, then your comments, let me just remind you, the proposal is that currently it's the accounting officer that appoints the audit committee, and the change is let's make the auditor general do it as opposed to the deputy from a governance point of view. So as you talk to these points, if you can make comment on that one so that we don't have to revisit it. And then, of course, the remunerations committee, consultation with Minister of Finance and anybody else, if you want to talk to that one. And, of course, the request to continue or to strengthen international work or international exposure. So as you take your second bite, if you could talk to those, and then we can allow the Auditor General and his team to go back and tighten it up a bit more. Where they think they need to tighten up, we will get draft two, and then we'll engage on draft two. So as members contribute on everything. All right. Any takers? I assume you were the first one. Or let's allow everybody to say something. All right. But we'll start with you, Singh, because I'm ambushing other members. But we will allow everybody just to have a general bite so that the AG can come up with draft two that we then can work with constructively. Let's start with you, Honorable Singh.
Thank you, Chair. I'll set the course with singing. Chair, no, thank you very much. I think it's a very, very useful interaction that we've had. And I've served on this committee for many years. And I think at last we are getting to grips with really what is needed in the 2016-17 circumstances of where we find ourselves in terms of governance. With the audit committee, I have no problem with that. It's a governance issue, no problem with that. The remunerations committee, I know I was part of a subcommittee on remunerations when we dealt with the current AG and what needs to be done. I've got no problem with that as well, from having the experience. The international work, yes, but charity begins at home. We've got a lot of work at home, maybe more work that we really can do. But charity begins at home, but I think we have to have international exposure. It's good, for us to have international exposure. There's just two other areas very quickly since we are looking broadly at issues. We raised the issue of performance auditing the last time, AG. And your response was that it was not easy to progress to performance auditing quickly. Performance audits require specific skills in a variety of disciplines, which we know and understand. And it's a systematic process. But maybe since we are looking at all these amendments and policies, etc., let us possibly consider a specialized unit within the office of the AG that can side by side do performance audits. So we catch up, because otherwise if we wait and look at this process, it'll be a never-ending catch-up game. So can we not consider going performance audit, do your audit without impinging on the responsibilities of the financial audit that's being done, if we identify areas where we need to do performance audits. So a specialized unit there. And then the management reports, I think, Chairperson, you remember we spoke about it. And the answer we got from the AG was that while there's an unwritten convention that management reports, are not made available to committees. Maybe now is the time for us to look at making it a written convention, one way or the other, because management reports are extremely useful documents. While you found it, Chair, and I found it in the SABC matter that we sat on, ad hoc committee. So maybe we must change the unwritten convention to a convention, which I think should lean on the side of it being made available, because that's where the nitty-gritty happens. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Chair. Chairperson, I would have loved to hear the comments from the AG about the fact that their recommendations are not enforceable. And when they are not enforceable, there could be some disputes arising out of your irregularities and your undesirable and so all those definitions. What would be your comment on that? On the enforceability of your recommendations. And we know that sometimes they are ignored, or at times, most of the time, they're being ignored out of a dispute on certain issues. How do we deal with that? On the international arena, I am of the opinion that because we pick up problems locally, there is a possibility of picking up problems at times out of in other places. And does that not have any bearing on the sovereignty of the country, as maybe a challenge to certain decisions or certain manner in which things were done? Thank you, Chair.
Honourable Bengu, do you want to have a bite, Ma?
Thank you, Chair. Thanks for the responses by the Auditor General. But my question is around the issue of the... We have seen that in the departments there are risk audit committees, and whether there is any role that is played by the Auditor General in assisting those risk and audit committees, because they found that the consistency of doing for several years, that you find the department is doing the same thing when it comes to the mismanagement of the public funds. And you'll hear that there are irregular expenditure that is always there for some time, but there is nothing that has been done so far. But there is a risk audit committee that is there in the department. Whether do you have any role to play in assisting those risk committees? Thank you very much. Thank you, Chair.
Thanks. We'll start by Mente and we'll end with Kuno. Mente, if there's anything, and then we'll come down this way and we'll end with Kuno. If you've got a second bite, Ma, if you don't, it's fine.
I'll just support the fact that all oversight bodies should have site or audit management letter. That's a very good point. And then my only concern with this amendment is that I'm hoping the Auditor General is asking for enough, and I remind him of that poem that says, I bargain with life for a penny, blah, blah, blah. I need to know that life would have given me whatever I demanded. So, you know, don't be scared to ask for power. And the word refer is not maybe so strong. Maybe you want to use a stronger word than just referring something. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. To the Auditor General and his team, it was very useful and it was very learning for me for the first time. I've learned a lot, and it is just the eye-opener for us to check on our local government departments where the problems is with service delivery, especially to the supply chain factors, which is the most cost of the problems. So it was very useful. Thanks.
Thank you so much, Honorable Chairperson. Page 6, Section 5, Clause BA, Clause C, and the sub, I don't know how to call this now, Clause BA for the remuneration. I agree with it, Chair. It's well crafted. There is no problem. That is the appointment of the committee members, the commissioner, and the majority that it must not from the staff of the Auditor General. That for me is perfect. I'm happy with that. Page 7, I've got a bit of a problem there. Where it says Auditor General consult with cabinet member responsible for finance. Why don't you just say it with Treasury instead of saying cabinet member? Why don't you just say with Treasury? Because it's Treasury that is supposed to consult with. And then the next one, which is new, I agree with it, in consultation with, which means the Remuneration Committee will be consulting with the Treasury. That's all that we are saying, isn't that so? If that's the case, then I agree with it. And
I want to go back to the threshold. It's not for now, Chairperson, but they need to apply their mind on this one, the Chair. Remember, in our other legislation, like an Oversight Act for intelligent, defense intelligence, crime intelligence, there are the clause, the legislation remains as is for the Auditor General on those sectors. However, though, the sourcing of information, then it becomes always a problem because of the activities that takes place there. So now when we revisit the threshold within the schedule of the relevant legislation, can you also look at that act so that at the end of the day, we don't have continuous problems in that sector. There are three of them, SSA, DI, SI. Thank you, Chair.
Chairperson, I think I'm happy with everything, but I strongly support the proposals as they are.
Thank you, Chair. I'm also supporting the proposals, but there is the one that was asked by Honorable Dubazane, which I think it was not answered. And just wanted to hear the policy versus regulation, because we're talking about something that is more the power. Which one is more powerful? And I would say, let's go for the powerful one. If the regulation is powerful, then let's go for the regulation. If it's a policy, then we go with the policy. Unless maybe we cannot go with the regulation, and we still have to stick with the policy. But I also want, Chair, to expand on the issue of the audit risk committees, that as much as we've been talking about local government, which I fully agree because it's a coal face of service delivery, but also the state-owned entities, I think they need a lot of assistance there. You know, the publicity that we are getting when it comes to SOEs, in terms of how they are managing their finances and all those things. I think they also need a lot of assistance from the AG's office over and above the local government, spheres of government. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chairperson. I've heard the recommendations, and I think I fully support them. But just to emphasize on what Honorable Ntombela said earlier on, the binding of the recommendations by the Auditor General, I think it needs to be taken serious. I think it's one of the loopholes that we have in the PFMA currently, and that's why it's not taken seriously. Chairperson, I also wanted I don't know if I should say reiterate, but the attacks on the system are supporting service delivery and achievement of goals. I think this is very important and key, and I think we need to dwell more into this. But again, Auditor General, we don't feel you enough, you know, as we deal with our entities. And I think we need to emphasize more on the entities because most of them are the ones that have they outsource the auditing to other firms, and I don't think that can be. I mean, if you look into the other firms and the Auditor General, how do you then link up and make sure that whatever we recommend today can be applicable to them? Because if I'm not working for the state and I've made recommendations, it's not really binding as one who's employed by the state. So I just want to hear your comment as far as that is concerned. Thanks, Chair.
Chair,
Chair, not really, but firstly, I just have to apologize for arriving late this morning, and that was one of the reasons why I didn't want to, because I didn't know if it was covered. But just one of the things that I would honestly like to say is that I really think that we need to start clamping down more on achieving goals. Because if a goal is not set and the funds are not spent specifically on what the goal was set for, we find ourselves with service delivery issues. So I feel that the AG needs to be given more teeth. And that is definitely just one of the points. But what is contained in the proposals and all of that, we absolutely agree with. Thank you.
AG, I don't know if we're giving you more work, but as we're saying, you can go and think about it and add to it or subtract from it. You know, we have this thing, AG, that I've harped on when I'm in Scopa. We give money to Department A. Department A then outsources that work to somebody else. And then the department then turns around and says, but we didn't break the law by not getting 3 tenders. It was somebody else that did it. And we've always said we're not going to outsource accountability. It might not be here, or you might have sufficiently covered it, AG. If you have it, it's fine. But this thing of outsourcing accountability because I gave it to somebody else, therefore, don't blame me. And yet the money was appropriated to the department. I'm not sure in Scopa how we concluded, but I'm of the strong view that if we gave money to Department X and that money was then ended up in undesirable financial outcomes or something, there's somehow that Parliament must still hold that department, or that department must understand if I outsource it, I outsource the risk of having a qualified or an undesirable outcome. So I'm not sure if it's covered here. If it's not, then you need to cover it. And then the other area, I'll probably be throwing the cat amongst the pigeons. I don't know how you resolved it, but I do know you raised it with me at some point. The equalization of employment conditions. I see here you've got a section on HR. But it's almost forward-looking. Now, I recall somewhere that we said we inherited certain staff members who were employed under certain conditions, which now differs sometimes even to the constitutional requirements or to... I'm not saying you must put it in here. I'm just asking the question, have you resolved that problem? Because you raised it as a concern at some point. I'm not saying it should be part of the amendments, but if it is, then maybe fit it in and let's debate it, that we can't have a situation where, because I've been there pre-94, when I retire with a Mercedes-Benz, and you were employed post-94, and when you retire, you can't go with anything. I'm being brutal, but that's the reality that we're facing, and I think Topem was saying, go for the jugular and we might shoot you down, but don't come back to us tomorrow and say you've got this difficulty and expect us to somehow intervene. So I'm saying just add it if you want to add it, and we'll shoot it down if we think it must be shot down. I saw Jenkins here. He is here. When we get draft 2, we will sit with the legal team and say how implementable, how legal and otherwise it is. But I'm just putting things that we've picked up in this term of office. I will allow Shoppe to have one more, then we'll close this chapter, have a break. Shoppe, Kuno, and Bengu, then we'll allow the AG to wrap up what he needs to do, have a 5-minute, 10-minute break, and then get on to the business of strat plan. Is that okay? Yes. Honorable Shoppe, and then Kuno, and then Bengu, and then AG, you and your team will wrap up, and we'll then discuss the way forward in terms of time frames.
Yes.
thank you, Chairperson. I just want to say something on the point you are raising on outsourcing, that departments come to SCOPA and say, but it is not our fault, we outsourced. I don't think it should be the problem of the Auditor General. The PFMA is very clear. When we made that, we discussed that bill in 1998, the letter and spirit of that bill was to allow managers to manage, but hold them to account. If the head of a department outsources responsibilities, it does not remove the accountability from him. He is still responsible to see to it that he is outsourcing that that responsibility to a firm that will do the work. But it is also, I don't know how you call it, you know, we had a course with vets. They say in the public service, there is this thing of the programs in a department must be monitored and evaluated on an ongoing basis. That is the responsibility of the head of the department, and it is the responsibility of the committee. In appropriation, we tell departments, there's no way the head of a department can come and tell us it is some so-and-so. Every blame goes to that person. It is the PFMA, it is not us.
Thank you, Chairperson. Much as I agree with what Honorable Chope is saying, it's a difficulty that we all facing. They know they have to account, but it's not done. So it means there's something that we have said that we're not implementing. You ask yourself, what is the gap? You know, because the legislation is there, but nobody's implementing. Because I think they know that there won't be any consequences. I think we need to have time, Chairperson, enough time to go through this legislation. So that, because, I mean, if you check the legislations that we've passed since 1994, most of them are difficult to implement. Because I think there are screws that do not, making a tie harder to make sure that at the end the government employees can feel that we are doing oversight, and it's really derailing us or derailing the progress of service delivery. So I'm just saying, I raise my hand to say to you, let's have enough chance to go through everything page by page, have our legal advisor from Parliament. I know we do have. And then go through this, and at the end of the day, apply our minds correctly. If we do it within an hour or so, it's not enough. And really, it's really frustrating, Comrade Sheila. We have a problem of accounting officers who wants to be lawless, and nobody's taking that into consideration. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. My question is, it's whenever the AG has not has met with the executive or accounting officers and had already identified the irregularities that has happened in the departments or entities, does the AG has ways to dealt with them? Because I remember one department, they said they used to meet with the Auditor General, and they find themselves that the Auditor General has to talk with an executive member or the minister or an accounting officer. But eventually, do you find that there is nothing that is happening after that? It's only that the AG will massage the situation, then they move on without even giving an opinion on that. Otherwise, it seems as if the accounting officers or the leader of the department, the minister, will not even take in the AG's findings seriously because of whatever meeting they have. And the other issue is around the issue of a fruitless expenditure because of the vacancies that are taking so long to be filled in the department that they does the and the use of consultants. Is the AG also assist on that? Because you find that many things, they are being outsourced by the department. That is why you've had some irregularities that are happening there and the mismanagement of funds for the department. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Just a quick reflection on a few issues raised. As far as the international work is concerned, we take note of this feedback regarding charity begins at home. We agree. However, if one looks at our commitment there, it's largely now in the continent. The major institution we audited, as I said, was the United Nations, which we did for 12 years up to 2012. We have had none of that type of audit. But those audits were self-funding when we were doing them. There was never a cent from the fiscals to finance any of that stuff. It was always paid for by those entities. And of course, it was always good because we are not busy every day, as in all the teams. Some of us are busy every day, but other people in the teams are not always busy every day. So we kind of have this incentive that to attract them as well as part of the employment opportunity. That's what was one of the key incentives, because they get excited when they are going to go and audit the pension fund of the United Nations in New York for 3 weeks when we're doing it. That was a nice incentive. Hence, today we can boast that we've got significant numbers of CAs. Some of them would go to places where they are busy with peacekeeping missions of the UN audits, and they discover when they get there that they are not allowed to cross a particular line. So it was a hectic experience, but that's past us. What we are involved with now is largely the stuff that's happening in the continent. And like I said, the AU, we audit together with four other countries from the other four regions of the continent. Our term will come up, obviously, because there's a rotation of different countries. We also collaborate as auditors with other two countries in the SADC region. It's not a very big assignment, but most of them we do pro bono, but they pay our out-of-pocket costs. But I think it's a contribution that we have even settled with the Minister of DERCO that we would want to contribute this as far as we can, because many of them, even in terms of advocacy work on the international space, Chair, if I might stretch it, the level of involvement that we have there is largely where we provide various levels of leadership across the global organization of audit institutions. For example, in the current period, we are the chair of the Capacity Building Committee of INTOSAI, which we co-chair as our deputy with Sweden. That's a massive responsibility because it brings to bear the influence on issues of the development of supreme audit institutions in a different platform. And of course, in the continent itself, as part of the AfroSci community. So there's a lot of involvement of that nature, because when we look back, many of these disciplines that we have, we did not have before. We used to go to those people to find them. Now that we've geared up, we also have an obligation to assist others and contribute to our own growth simultaneously. So that's our level of involvement. But this one that we are isolating was where we are required to express opinions. I think there's not much of it. As I said, it's all confined now in the continent. Management reports, we take the feedback. And recently, in fact, as yesterday, I had a chat with one of the mayors who was also raising this matter. And the mayor was saying, well, the accounting officer is telling me that I'm not entitled to get access to a management report, but I'm a mayor. So there's something that has broken in the system here, which from a communication point of view needs to be pulled back, because principally a management report is an official document of feedback to the institution to ensure that those that are charged with governance engage with the matters that are raised in an audit, because the audit report does not go to that detail. It flags at a high level, whereas the management report tells you what's broken, how is it broken, what must be done to fix it. And I think that document should not be limited to some and not available to others. But we'll have a look at this. And I think if there's something that's broken in the regulation of a matter like this, we probably would need to pull it back. The recommendation for enforceability. The issue of enforceability, Babu Ndombela, is twofold. What you are saying here about the enforceability of recommendations, if you look at Section 182.1c, of the Public Protector Act, it specifically says that issue, remedial action. What you are saying about enforceability here is that there is no such in our Public Audit Act which says issue,
a remedial action. Now, because of that, it does not mean the enforceability of the recommendations of the Auditor General cannot be exercised by those that are charged with oversight, because they can. If the people charged with oversight had raised the bar, they would have been able to enforce these recommendations themselves without giving that instrument to the audit office, because that's where the power lies, ultimately. So it's a misnomer in one way, in the sense that it's not enforceable in writing through us, but the recommendation that we surface, where and if it makes sense to those that are charged with governance, it's their responsibility to enforce it. Otherwise, if that was in place, we wouldn't be having the conversation about this particular mechanism. We would have dropped this mechanism as a consideration. Risk and audit committees, as well as those in the executive, there's a program that we had set out over many years. It's still running to this day, where we provide that support on the issues that are raised in the report. For all risk management units, we engage quite extensively, even in some audits that we are not the signing entity. We sit down with the ones who are the principal auditors from the private sector and say, have you taken this into account? Have you not? We do have that engagement. So we'll continue this and make sure that we deepen that level of accountability, because also here we have incorporated issues pertaining to the performance audit, for example. Performance audit we have highlighted here. We've even gone further in strengthening the hand of performance audit to say, in addition to the point you are raising, Honorable Singh, to say that our Public Audit Act has got two streams through which we can raise funding. So as we are making the effort to grow the performance audit unit, we get stuck now because you can't bill it directly. It's not a mandatory statutory exercise. So what we are proposing as part of these amendments, which we didn't go into detail with, is all here as well, is that we've got to now trigger access to that appropriation. So if there's a quantum of resources that has been set aside, so it's not at the beck and call of the accounting officer to decide whether we are going to do that performance audit or not. We'll say we've got the appropriation for it, we have to do it. So that's what we are putting in here. So it is here. The issue pertaining to state-owned entities, we've also covered it here in the... If I talk about performance audit, on top of page 5, Honorable Singh, you'll see there that under E, where we say perform an appropriate audit of any institution referred to determine whether adequate measures have been implemented to ensure that resources are procured economically and utilized efficiently and effectively. So this is referring to also extending the work to those entities that are audited outside of the Auditor General. So we are bringing the mechanism to have the level of scrutiny even in those state-owned entities, including regularizing the performance of performance audits. Right. Implementing agents, the one that you raised, Chair, I think it's your one. There's an interesting issue here when the matter on SASA was picked up in the Constitutional Court, where after all the deliberations, there was a conclusion that says if you give your money to these people to do their distribution, then by definition they become part of the public entities. There's something there in judgment, in Judge Frontman's judgment, that talks to a matter like this. So if we give it to you, it doesn't change the complexion that it belongs to the public still, almost. So I think it is in the implementation of some of these decisions, I think, which also come through the courts, where some of the clarity has already been provided in terms of this. Chair, the matter around the equalization of employment conditions and as well as where we are now, as I said when I reported the matter, we were challenged by people who used to be at the office who are now retired as far as the issues pertaining to post-medical retirement. So we've had to spend a significant amount of time, close to just over 6 months, where we had to be responding to court papers. So we've made our submissions and all of that with regards to pushing back on this matter, but we kind of waiting to see how it flows out of the court system. But I agree that at the level of setting the direction from a accountability point of view, that was our initial preference before those people decided to take us to court. We said we're going to come to this committee at the end of the financial year that we reported on to seek counsel as to how to proceed with matters of that nature, because we've got a generation of new staff who do not necessarily enjoy those benefits that were there in the pre-93 period, but they are part of the same setup. They are part of having to expose themselves to all of these issues as we speak. However, we wanted to respect that court process to unfold so that the legislative instrument can take part in this whole thing to say, where are we going with this? What was the intention initially of the legislator when they put together this transitional arrangement with similar benefits for others and not for the others? That is the kind of stuff that we thought could best be ventilated here after, obviously, we've consummated the stuff that has gone through the courts. So we'll keep you posted on how it's evolving. We have not yet been informed as to when it is going to start seeing the light of day at that level. Chair, I'm getting closer now to finishing up. Just one thing, Chair, that I thought as we are preparing ourselves now for this journey, obviously there's a huge expectation from our staff. They work with these things every day, and I think we would like to register our appreciation as well to the staff in the audit office for helping us in getting this far. And I think that there's a huge amount of opportunity that this exercise will provide, not only in narrowing the spaces that we spoke about, but also in giving the level of satisfaction to these people who commit hours and hours on this. But they know that if they themselves know that the same thing they are reporting on is likely to be the same in the next 5, 7, 10 years, you can imagine what it does to the possibility of a corrosive effect on the institution over time. And I think no one wants an institution like this and others to go down because the soul at the heart of it was not in the right place. So, Chair, let me conclude then, as well as in thanking the Deputy AG and the rest of the executive team, I think, who have toiled over many difficult audits over time, and say that we could not have been here if the bulk of the team in the office had not pushed their own staff. When I stand up and speak about these audit outcomes, sometimes I might come across as if I'm the one who saw the records, but I've never seen any one of those records. But we trust that the system that we've got in place, as well as the disciplines that we have in place, are the ones that have been tried and tested elsewhere. And so you will probably not be disappointed when you see that we consistently come up with the same issues, because we believe that's the best way to do it. A closing shot, Chair, you know, when we prepare for these things, sometimes we go and draw lessons from people who have seen and done these things before. And I thought, let me draw from the works of Jean-Jacques Rousseau, who was writing in the Discourse on Political Economy, and I quote, "The man who once gets the better of remorse will not shrink before punishments which are less severe and less lasting, and from which there is at least the hope of escaping. Whatever precautions are taken, those who only require impunity in order to do wrong will not fail to find means of eluding the law and avoiding its penalties. The reward of virtue soon becomes that of robbery. The vilest of men rise to the greatest credit. The greater they are, the more despicable they become. Their infamy appears even in their dignities, and their very honors dishonor them," unquote. Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you very much, AG. Just one point to emphasize that you made in response to Honorable Ntombela's point. You know, if we are brutally honest with ourselves as legislators, it's a lack of political will. It's a lack of political will. The PFMA is very clear. This is what accounting officer must do. And then there's a section that says, if not, this is what needs to be done. So both
public representatives in the executive and in the legislature should take some of this responsibility. It should never have got to a point where we need to strengthen this if we did our work. But it will help us, maybe, AG, to do that. Just in terms of the way forward, honorable members, we will send a program out later on, but our thinking, AG, is that if what we're now calling draft two, we come back from recess round about the 1st of August. If by then we could have draft two, end of July, 1st of August, members will then have sight of it. We will try and set up phase two of this meeting or the follow-up of this meeting, maybe towards the latter part of August, the 18th, 25th of August, for us then to have this discussion around draft two. And after we release you, we will then sit as a committee, deliberate, and do everything. Because, honorable members, I think if we are unable to take these amendments to Parliament before the end of October, then it's not going to happen in this term of Parliament, because 2018, by and large, is going to be elections year. So we would need to work backwards from, let's say, October coming back this way. If we really are serious about amending this Act, I think we have to present it to Parliament by the end of October. If we have any hope of this thing being in place, even not in our lifetime as this committee, but certainly when the new committee comes in after 2019, that it's there. So we will work back from October backwards. So AG, you have about 6 weeks to tighten up. We will, honorable, know when we come back on the 18th, get a report back, and then set another day where we just, with Jenkins and others, sit and go through it, so that at the latest by October, let's take something to the House, if we are serious about making this thing a reality, or certainly be our legacy, even if we don't enjoy the fruits of it. But this committee would have set the platform for the incoming committee post 2019. Mr. Singh, sir.
So just a very silly question, Chairperson. Who introduces the amendments? Because normally legislation, maybe Jenkins can help us later, is introduced by a member of the executive. But Parliament has introduced, like we did on the on the money-related matters. Well, is this committee now, are we empowered to bring it forward?
Jenkins will answer that, but if memory serves me correctly, this Act was set up by an ad hoc committee that I chaired. We as Parliament introduced the Public Audit Act, but Jenkins will come and tell us exactly the processes when it arrives. But if memory serves me correctly, we set up an ad hoc committee to implement this very Act. I chaired that ad hoc committee, so I'm sure it is us that does it. But if it's not us, Jenkins, you'll help us at the end of August, who in fact does it. It's a committee bill. It's a committee bill is what the clever people are saying to us. Yeah. All right.
Sorry, Chair. Before Advocate respond. Okay. What we have just proposed, I'm adding that while we are waiting for the presentation of the draft two, we also invite the public hearings. Because it's part of the amendments. If we do any amendments, the public has to be involved. If Advocate.
Okay. We will do all that. That's why I'm saying Jenkins will assist us, so that when we get there, there's no challenges. If it means that we must have a public hearing, we'll incorporate it. If it means anything, Jenkins, you will help us, you and Cindy and everybody else will, when we come back, be able to say these are the things you need to do so that you are not challenged at the end of August. Yeah. All right. So we'll incorporate that part of it. Honorable members, at that point then let's break for tea and say to the AG and his team, thank you very much. After this, we will sit by ourselves and
chart the way forward for this committee, including what we've just spoken about now. It's really our strat plan. What do we want to do? How do we want to do it? When do we want to do it? And it shouldn't be too long. So, AG, once again, you and your team, thank you very much. As usual, via Cindy to Adil, we will send the program where we will just look at this thing, your phase two of it. And we are, I think, all in agreement that we must have this thing adopted before the end of October if you want to see any meaningful changes come the next parliament. Thank you very much. Honourable members, it is, can we be back at 11:30? Is that okay? 11:30, so you've got about 10 minutes. 11:30, and you'll take over from 11:30. Thank you very much.
Yeah, they said carry on.
We'll get the, don't worry about the names.
They wouldn't, maybe. They wouldn't.
I think, yeah, they were not interested because that's what I wanted to ask them, because they are legislative.
Yeah.
I think the old one of them, you can tell some matter, I don't know, can you visualize that overarching one, the consequences of the decision, that's why we are here. Consequences.
And that's just light,
eh? Yeah, that is light. That's light.
So, as long as you know.
items lapha ku agenda
But I get the point. What do you mean? Mustalen Madaba. Yeah, I'm hoping this year. Okay. Okay. Just very briefly now, because people will be running.
But I think it's very important because there are new members that are coming.
Yeah. Hey. That's good. I could see you strong. I'll give you a something. All right, honourable members, I've been advised by wiser people than me that the first order of business right now, whilst we're still correct, is that we should formally, as a committee, adopt a resolution that if this thing must surface before Parliament, that we take it to the powers that be in Parliament, whether they give us the permission to do it as this committee or as an ad hoc committee, so be it. So I'm putting it to the House. Whether it is okay that we take a resolution as this committee that there's going to be a need for amendments to the current Public Audit Act, and that the relevant structure or vehicle to do that should look at it, and we will, if necessary, provide that vehicle the support. So I'm putting it formally that we adopt it, that we can proceed to the powers that be in Parliament that we think this is the route to go. Can we have an indication of people that feel that it's the way to go? All right. It's agreed. Thank you very much. Okay, so we will then indicate that we think this is the route to go, and then that Parliament takes whatever steps are necessary, whether they set up an ad hoc committee or give us the powers. We will do that. Cindy will prepare some sort of a communique to the powers that be. Thank you very much, honourable members, on that one. Just to reiterate again, honourable members, this really is is our strat plan, and I did indicate to the researcher that, and it will be good for those members that are maybe brand new, but it will also be useful for us as a refresher. Just to remind members that when we set up this committee, and you can change it if you want, when we set up this committee, we had agreed that this committee meets quarterly, because ours is really, for want of a better word, the shareholder of the AG. Look at his annual report, look at are we happy that he is, in from a governance point of view, changing his auditors, remuneration committee, and so on. So this committee doesn't meet like other committees on a regular basis. So in terms of a strat plan, it's not like we're going to sit and say this is what we're doing this month and this is what we're doing next month, but it's going to help us in terms of what our mandate is. So we've asked the researchers just to briefly take us through it. We have in our packs, and also Cindy indicates we all received this document, which obviously will change slightly if resolution is passed. We have the rules of parliament, and we have all the documents that members have had. So we're just going to ask you, sir, to very briefly take us through the high-level points that you think that members must be aware of. And after that is done, if there are any engagements, we'll engage, and then thereafter we can reconfirm how we think we want to go forward as a committee. Is it still appropriate to do it the way we did it? Once a month, it's a committee that meets on a Friday, by the way. We're one of those committees that meet on Fridays. So after that and after the engagement, our strat plan really is where do we want to go to and how do we get there? Shouldn't be too difficult to do that. So if it's okay with you, sir, can we give you half an hour? Is it sufficient time? So around about 12:15. There is lunch at arranged. I've just asked Cindy to maybe move it to 1 o'clock. Yeah. If we move it to 1 o'clock, can we then agree that we will try and finish our business so that when we break for lunch at 1 o'clock, we have lunch and we go if we want to go? It gives us just over an hour. Is that okay? So you've got half an hour till about quarter past twelve, sir, and then from 12:15 to 1 o'clock, we engage and we craft the way forward. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Chair. Greetings to the members and my colleagues. Actually, what I'm going to present is just a mandate as it been written, and also the key issues that I picked up in the committee that we have to be taken some strategic decision on how going to deal with them so that they can be part and parcel of our plan going forward. We have to recall that, honorable members, that in fact, we should have had this strategy plan 2 years ago, because the strategy plan is supposed to cover this fifth parliament. But now, what we're going to have is going to be a three-year plan. As Chairperson has just indicated, he alluded even before, even that three-year plan, sometimes we have to be very careful of it, because there are some other terms that we might lose during 2019, for example. So whatever we're going to agree here, we have to be in cognizance of that. As I just said, from emanating from what the AG and the team has presented, we picked up some key issues. Mostly were emanating from the legislation, and also us, we picked up some key issues. At the end of the day, these key issues are going to identify or create some the community priorities and community strategic objectives and plans for these three remaining years. That's the reason why I present this, what I'm going to present now. Okay, I'm not going to go further. Let's start with the presentation. I'm not going to go I'll start on page 4 of the presentation, the mandate of the of this committee. Page 4. The mandate of the committee, as we know, is derived from the Constitution of South Africa, Section 55(2)(b), Roman Figure 2. We know that is that the NA must provide for a mechanism to maintain oversight of any state of any organ of the state, and of which AG falls on that organ of the state in the definition of an organ of the state. If you from section 239 of the definition of an organ of the state, it says any institution or constitutionally created by constitution, national or even provincial constitution. So That's the reason why we have this committee, and also Public Audit Act. This also the one that is one of the mandate that derives the is one of the legislation or act that derives the mandate of this committee. In particular, Section 2C, we say that we must assist and protect the AG to ensure its independence, impartiality. And also in the Public Audit Act, we also have Section 10(3), which says that the National Assembly must provide for a mechanism to maintain oversight over AG in terms of Section 55(2)(b), Roman figure 2 of the Constitution, and also National Rules of, that is 249, that creates or establishes the oversight mechanism. This is Standing Committee on Auditor General. We recall that this committee has been established by, it's a standing committee because it's legislated and also established by National Rules of Parliament. Going forward, then from those three, in particular from the Public Audit Act and the Constitution, we derived some powers and functions of the committee, what the committee is supposed to do indeed. So in particular from the Constitution, Section 56, and I think this is also going to answer the concern that was having Honorable Singh, whether we can invite National Treasurer to come and present in those issues that he raised. Yes, of course, because this committee is also empowered in terms of Section 56 of the Constitution. That Section 56 allows the committee to summon any person to appear before it or give evidence or oath or affirmation or to produce any evidence. So we can call National Treasurer. If any institution in fact that want to call, we can call, because this committee is also empowered in terms of Section 56. Then from the powers and functions of the committee, I separated them or disaggregated into two. I picked up the main legislative powers and function and other legislative powers and function. The reason that I segregated, what method I have used, the main legislative powers and function, I've used the frequency and the frequency and importance of those functions that we must do, in particular annually. We have to know and do when we're supposed to do those, we have to perform those functions as the committee. Because all these functions and powers are the function and powers of the committee that we must do what we're supposed to perform annually. For example, the first one that I derived from 2C, of course, is this one, is assist and protect the Auditor General in order to ensure impartiality, independence, and effectiveness. So here we have to assist it. I don't know how can I explain further, but in assisting, we have tried in assisting most of the time. For example, I don't know how many times we've been writing a recommendation in our annual report and strategy plan that we have to meet, the committee, we have to meet or invite the Department of COCTA, for example, and National Treasurer, as far as the challenge that was facing the AG in terms of a high debt of non-payment of by local government. So we are trying to assist. To protect, so far I'm not sure, we have never came across with that, but one of the things that we normally say to the AG, even in previous years, we normally say we have a little bit concerned of most of the time when they table their, for example, MFMA or PFMA, their audits, their audit outcomes, for example, for PFMA. We normally, they know, most of the times, even in the three previous consecutive years, we just see as a committee on the Pretoria, then the AG table and brief the media without coming and brief the committee. And then we ask this question, what about if something terrible might happen? How are we going to protect you as the AG? Because they're supposed to come and brief the committee before they brief the media in terms of PFMA outcomes and MFMA. We have been consistently and engaging the AG, the previous colleagues, staff that were there before that. Can you please ensure that before you go and brief, in particular with the outcomes of PFM and MFP, who are significant, come and brief the committee first so that whenever there might be something that might crop out of those things, so we can be able to protect you. How are we going to protect you after, I mean, hearing on the meeting, the news, and then something broke up and then we have never come and brief us before you go to the media? Then the only thing that has been always been consistent on them that we have requested this, but I doubt if we've never. I think last year they were attempting to comply, but because we didn't, I think they sent some requests to have a briefing, but unfortunately I think it was already late because of the programs of Parliament. We couldn't sit to listen to, I mean, to engage with them. And another one is to advise the National Assembly. We advise the National Assembly through our reports that, I mean, through the recommendation that we send to the National Assembly and ATC. And we also, this one, I'm not sure because I also spoken with Advocate Jenkins with this one, to recommend to the National Assembly the appointment of the AG. It's one of the powers and functions that we have. But since since I've been employed in Parliament and I've been told of even in history, that this committee has never been given that task to appoint UAG. It's always been done by ad hoc committee. I maintain the view, even the previous chairperson to Honorable Masood, when I was advising that, I think according to Section 1935, it said that the committee of the National Assembly proportionally represented. To me, this committee is proportionally represented. It's a committee of National Assembly. Why is not given to this committee? I think even that time, Alfred Jenkins concurred with me. But unfortunately, then they correspond just right from get from the speaker. Speaker say that decided on the speaker, the former speaker, that the appointment should be subjected through an ad hoc committee. I'm not sure why this has already been given to ad hoc committee, but it's one of them. Functions, the powers and functions that I think is also vested to this committee. And even Advocate Jenkins, when we have some discussion previously, he couldn't establish the reasons. And another one is to consider the budget and business plan of the AG and submitting the recommendation to the speaker. Here, we normally, the Act says, Section 31, 38, 2, that before the start of the financial year of the AG, the AG must submit its business plan and the budget to the oversight mechanism. I think Section 38 to that one. So the oversight mechanism have to consider that submission. That is, if you look at the term, it's a 6 months before the start of the financial year, which means it's about August. September, which means the AG must submit that to the committee. And then the section 38.3 says that the committee, after receiving that, within 2 months of receiving that, the committee have to report to the National Assembly. So this is one of our key milestones or key output that we expected to do. We receive this business plan and budget. And then within the 2 months after we received, we have to report back to the House, to the Speaker and also National Treasurer. And then another one is to approve the retention of the total surplus. We did it annually, this thing. Section 38.4, it says that whenever that is left, surplus that is generated by the AG at the end of each financial year, it should be the ages must consult the committee in order to propose or so that the committee can recommend to the total retention of the surplus or part or a portion. Therefore, if for example we have agreed that no AG we recommend that no AG must not retain the total surplus, must retain some portion, which means that another portion that is left have to be surrendered to the National Revenue Fund. So which means that I don't think it's the ideal situation considering the current challenges that AG is facing in terms of finances. I mean, with those debts that are accumulating, and the most of the auditees are unable to pay auditor general. So that will impede the cash flow. That will result to AG to have some challenges in terms of cash flow. So I think it is better in most of the time that we normally recommend the total retention of the total surplus. And also another one is the AG must annually appoint the external auditor to audit the financial statements of the Auditor General. We normally do this thing in terms of Section 39.1. Each and every year when we consider annual report, we normally appoint the external auditor. And also another function of powers and functions is to annually report to the National Assembly on this administration, annual report financial statements and audited financial statement. This is what called is annual report. The annual report is accompanied by the audited financial statements of AG. So the annual report normally the Act says that after 6 months after the end of financial year, the Auditor General must submit annual report to the oversight mechanism, that is to the committee, and then after that we consider this annual report and report back to the House, the National Assembly. And to approve the audit tariffs, I think Section 38.1, which says that the Auditor General must consider the basis on which the audit fees for the year which relates budget and the following year. So which means here, when Auditor General, in particular, when they submit their business plan and budget, they also have to explain to the government. They normally do that, explain on how the audit fees or the audit tariffs, the audit fees are going to be charged going forward. So that in order to charge the audit tariffs, we must have also considered how much if they propose, say that, for example, the increase in audit tariffs, because audit tariffs determines the audit fees that are going to be received by Auditor General going forward. So we normally approve the audit tariffs, where they normally propose, AG normally propose that they want to increase by certain percent, which is maybe they have their motivation, which is inflationary adjusted percentage, for example, whatever reason they normally give it. But we normally consider and approve the audit tariff. That's one of the things that the committee normally does annually. And another main legislative power and function is to issue code of conduct. Prescribing the standards of professional and conduct in performance of an audit and their function. We normally consider this in terms, then we normally approve and consider them in terms of audit directives as per required by Section 12.4 of the Act. So these are the main key powers and functions that we do as a committee. Annually, we have to approve these audit directives, which are accompanied by the business plan and budget. When we consider business plan and budget, we have also considered the audit directives that AG normally applies to us. And also we consider annual report, which normally around August they have to table, because the Act says that the annual report have to be tabled to the committee 6 months after the end of the financial year. And also we also determine and recommend the retention of surplus and appoint the external auditor annually. And also we consider their business plan. These are the key issues, these are key main legislative powers and functions that we normally do annually, and their frequency is annual. As I said, other powers refer to powers and functions that are not frequent, that were not the frequency of doing them is low. We are not doing them, we are not performing them in particular annually. We perform them whenever they came to us, like the appointment of Auditor General and determine the standards applied to performance audits. These are we perform those powers and functions whenever they came in to us and the request sent to us. Emanating from these powers and functions, I derive the key issues that need strategic power, strategic decision. For example, one of them is from emanating from the legislative issue. In fact, here, I know it's a governance. The Act has already covered the governance in terms of an audit committee, because it's one of the issues that the committee have recommended, they've raised concerns in front of the committee and before that. How come that the audit committee is appointed by the AG, DAG, of which DAG is accounting officer? So you say he's playing a riff and they play at the same time. But here, on this presentation that was done by the AG, obvious that matter has been covered. But the matter that is still not yet been covered, as my view, is the appointment of external audit. I said the process to appoint the external auditor. I refer to the fact that the DAG appoints the audit committee. The audit committee then appoints the external auditor. You see that the person that appointed the audit committee is DAG, of which the audit committee further appoints the external auditor. So you see there was an conflict of interest, because the very same person that the external audit is going to audit is the very same person indirectly appointed the external audit. So that was the process. But I'm glad that now they said that they're going to change it. It's going to be H is going to appoint the AC, so the audit committee. Therefore, the audit committee is going to appoint the external audit. But another thing that I raised here is the profile, the act, in the act, and in section 39.3 said, The person or external auditor may be a person on the employ of the auditor general. I doubt if that can really be, the integrity of those outcomes and the audit outcomes. If, for example, I'm an employee of auditor general and at the same time I'm the external auditor of the auditor general. So I said, rather than use may, we must say must, because the external auditor, because the act currently says that even that external auditor may be in the staff of an employee of AG. So I'm imagining a situation where, for example, myself, I'm an employee of AG. Then I'm also appointed as an external auditor of AG, as the act is allows now. It really is a conflict of interest. That's what I even raised in the document there. That I think we have to amend it, make sure that it is a, it says that it must not be. I think the act must deal with that. And also another thing that I raised is that I'm not sure whether, because the act says that this committee must appoint the external audit. I'm not sure whether we are not limited as a committee if, for example, normally the AG will come and present only one name. Because I think the recommendation is supposed to come with three names, and then we engage with them, and then we end up appointing from the three name or whatever, three name maximum of three name or four name, whatever number. But we have empowered to choose out of those numbers. But each and every year, normally been given, one name. The AG normally recommends one name that come to us. And then we don't have a choice. We appoint. I doubt that whether we are really been given. That is not limiting our powers that have been given by the Act to appoint. Why are you not giving the number of recommendations rather than one person, one external audit that is recommended to us? So that's why I was saying that I'm not sure this one, how can we, but not in the Act, I'm not sure how can we, maybe we can engage with them that wherever you submit or you submit the person or company that is recommended as an external auditor, we must give us at least three names rather than the one that is normally fed to us. Another key issue here was the retention of a surplus. We know.
Chair, I'm so sorry, and I'm sorry for stopping you. I was just wondering, we're going through this whole process right now. Wasn't it maybe advisable for us to actually have Advocate Jenkins here? Because some of the things that are being mentioned is things that honestly sounds like it might be a personal view, okay, that we have some guidance here. Because there's things where I have a total different view, but at least if we still had Advocate Jenkins here, you know, we're not wasting any time, but I'm just trying to assist.
Before okay. I allow you, Honourable Dubazane, we thought that we'll get this briefing. Remember on the 23rd, we're having the legal department here looking at not only this issue, but also looking at even the stuff that AG will be bringing to us. So at that point, we can clarify some of these things. But I don't think it will detract from from the roadmap in terms of when we should do what. The what we can further refine with some legal advice, if that's okay with you, ma'am. Thanks. Dubazan, and then Banza.
No, Chair. I was going to say, for the following from what the Honourable Member has actually said, because as the researcher is talking, you'll find that most of the things have been addressed by the Auditor General on the amendments that are to be done, so that we allow him to finish up his presentation. But we don't engage because the document came today and the members never got time to read them, to read. So because they've just received them now, then they take them home. We receive the rest from Cindy, but not this one. And then they can, when we come back, then maybe there will be some things that they pick them up. But we allow him to finish up the presentation, and then that's it.
Yes, Chair, I will agree with that. But I think when I look at the time that you've allocated us, it seems as if the researcher is just reading sentence by sentence. And I think maybe if you can just summarize, give an executive summary of the most important aspects of the presentation, I think it will help. But I think he's helping us a lot.
Okay, thank you, Chair. Actually, let me continue. Actually, that one was the only one, the legislative one that I've picked up. Another one is the retention of a surplus. I think here, the background, we've been recommending approving the retention of the surplus by AG, which we approve in terms of as the general reserves. But we have requested them that they must come and produce the definitive plans and tamper on how they are going to use that particular spend, that particular surplus. But until today, there's never that we have never received any such kind of plans, any information on how this surplus that we approve, that we prove to A to for AG, how is the AG is going to use it. I think this is not, to me, I said the reason why I highlighted this is because, for example, we will not be able to know how this surplus has been generated, because it might be generated because most, like for the previous one, it was unspent fund. So we even, for example, the chairpersons in the committee even raised some concerns with those unspent fund, that because the surplus was because of the unspent fund, whether it's not directly affecting the performance or plans and also the target that each had for the annual, for that particular previous year. So we are not privy to know what causes that particular surplus, because it might be due to unspent funds, as I said, or secondly, it might be due that they are increasing charging much more of audit tariff, the audit fees. They are increasing the percentage of audit tariff that we approve here is more than, because that's the reason why they end up generating the income, the surplus. Because if that more income rather than compared to the cost or expenditures, then we end up having surplus. So that's what we normally are not considering. We don't know how does this surplus that H is is generating, how is being generated. Secondly, is the issue of outstanding fees. Outstanding debts. Here, there are two issues. There are those outstanding debts emanated from unaffordability of municipalities, most present local government, to pay those financial distress municipalities, as we normally say. But there are also those one in the provincial national departments, which is not. I know that the problem is not prevalence in the national and provincial government, but it's prevalence in the local government. But what is happening here is that these fees, if the national and provincial government continue not to pay these fees, I think this also impacts negatively in the cash flow of Auditor General, and thereby it also affects negatively, because AG Norm will remember sometimes when it outsources its services, it outsources to small, medium, micro enterprise firms so that they can audit on its behalf. So if you don't pay, if the national and provincial government departments are unable to pay timely to Auditor General, it affects those SMMEs that Auditor General have outsourced them in order for transformation, in order to improve transformation in the audit sector, and in order to empower the SMME development. So it also has some negative impact. So and the audit, the issue of audit performance audits have already been dealt with. And at the end, I put some recommendations there. One of the recommendations that I put in terms of the retention of the surplus was, of course, that the AG must be furnished with these definitive plans so that we can consider on how this the revenue is being generated. Second, in the issue of outstanding fees, outstanding debts, we also say that while these outstanding debts rather than litigation can be treated in a similar manner, like the 30-day period, payment period is currently treated in the government, because I understand that the 30-day period has become even a part and is being a part in the contract of the accounting officers, I mean, currently, if my memory serves well. And also, there was also commission that Mahmoud Dubas and the Public Service Committee that they also consider, because really, at the end of the day, this have a negative impact in the SMME development, because when these national government and provincial government continue not to pay those audit fees, of which they can pay or deliberately done so, it affects the SMMEs, those SMMEs that are employed by the Auditor General to audit, because it's also outsourcing their functions. And also enhance the members of the committee, the capacity. Here we talk about attending some workshops and training workshop, and also to venture into some study tours, I mean, in order to learn the best practices in other countries. Thank you, Chair.
I hope you are not intimidated. You are. You learn as you go on. Chairperson Kodi, welcome. And maybe it's very useful that you hear, Chair, as the primary client of the AG, you might be able to also give us some input, although, as you can see, we are at least three that serve on your committee, so we've been able to. Honourable members, as suggested by colleagues Carter and others, this is but part one, and we will tighten it up when we next meet with the legal team. But really, ours is to oversee the Auditor General, and the services that the Auditor General provides in the main is that of providing an opinion on the financial statements that belong to the departments. It's not his financial statements. The department, he goes and audits and gives us an opinion as a means towards effective oversight. So I think we need to, when we do our work, is to answer the question whether that service that he's providing to Honorable Gordy and his team, and to every other MP, by the way, whether that is really doing what it was supposed to do, because he's supposed to be a institution that supports democracy. That's what the AG's job is, an institution that supports democracy. And oversight is part of ensuring democracy. So we need to answer the question. One, do we think that the quality of work, the capacity of the AG is achieving that goal? And I think the second one that the researcher was talking about is, as the protectors of the Auditor General, we need to make sure that he remains sustainable and a going concern. Because if all the auditees stop paying audit fees or stop paying it timely, they'll drive him out of business. Constructive dismissal or whatever you call it or whatever. So those are mainly our roles. And the question is, how do we do that? How do we ensure that the AG does what he does? Honorable Gordy, you could also... in helping us answer that question, also proffer, I mean, there is Kuno and Mente, and we've been lamenting on some of the things we pick up in Scope, but not really the AG's fault. And just to bring you up to speed, Chairperson Gordy, this morning's session was tightening up the AG's role, exactly that his recommendations become more binding, and we explored all sorts of ways and we will propose amendments to that. So it will assist you even in your committee that it's not just an ongoing lamentation or serial offender. So that was the morning session, and now we're answering the question, if that's what we want the AG to do, how do we as Parliament ensure that he's able to do that? And if what he's doing currently satisfies our needs. So that's really the questions that we need to answer, taking into consideration everything else. So let's open it up to members. As I also indicated, I'll come to you, as I also indicated, you'll also talk to whether our current method of work is fine. Our current method of work when we started was that we'll meet quarterly, over and above when we need to meet him to check his annual financial statements. Because ours is really the board of the AG, for want of a better word. Ours is not more than that. So is our work method still appropriate? How do we ensure that he is doing what he's supposed to do? And if he's not, how do we bring him back into, him or her back into line? And thirdly, how do we safeguard that the AG, because he's, as you said earlier on, by his very nature, not antagonistic, but there's always that tension between him and the auditees. How do we ensure that he's protected? So those are the questions that I think we should try and answer and then chart the way forward, honourable members. And I'd noted honourable Bengu as the first one, and then okay, let's just go down this way. Everybody will just have a bite, and as you have your bite, you'll also suggest how we take all these things forward, having heard what we heard this morning.
Okay, thank you, Chairperson, and thanks for the presentation by the researcher. But I would like to say that maybe in future, if we can have a research document from the researcher so that we can be able to refer to some of the issues that he has identified, because we know that we don't meet on regular basis with the Auditor General. So if there are any issues that have been tackled out by the researcher, should be given to us so that we can be able to ask the Auditor General while he's here in the meeting. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, I just have to say, I've got to say thank you. I did have my documents. It was in the pigeonhole, but there was time that was actually, that we just did not have the time to go through it, but we did receive it. I think a very important matter, and I think it's a matter that I've raised with you before, to say, what is this committee? Are we really just a rubber stamping committee? I honestly feel that even, and maybe this is deliberations we can have, and especially with having Honourable Gordy as well. But I feel when, say, for example, the AG is giving his report on local government or municipalities, shouldn't we at least also know what is going to happen? Because at this stage, we hear about it in the media, we hear about it from SCOPA, and I feel that we should really be the first body to know, or with us and SCOPA together. But it's a question of we can't read about things in the media. So that is definitely one point that I would make a proposal, that we need to try and give ourselves a little bit more teeth, because we have an oversight role to play. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. I am of the opinion, Chair, that the sustainability of the integrity of the AG is much dependent on the political will. You indicated that earlier. So it is therefore incumbent upon us as the committee that if it comes to a push, we shall have to engage with the leader of the business of what would you call it? Yeah, the leader of the government business, so that the recommendations that we make be effective, because it cannot be that we just turn ourselves into a talk shop, so to speak. Because whatever that we are going to do will taper into nothing if we don't take drastic measures to making sure that we protect the AG. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair. No, Chair, mine is just, firstly, with the surplus that the AG must retained? And where is it coming from? Who was not paid in order for that money to be there? If we can then get that, it's disturbing. If the AG cannot be able to pay SMMEs, and then there's other people that are owing the AG, at the very same time, the AG must go back to these departments and audit them. It brings some confusion, and I'm not clear. But what I want to say is that, can we be cleared as to how does this happen? Is it because he has a shortfall, or why he gets to a point of having money but the SMMEs are not paid? And then lastly, Chair, Editor General is a Chapter 9 institution. Okay, we seek now to give the Auditor General some powers. But I believe that if we were to dig deeper in terms of legislation, we would find something that will assist in the meantime with the committee to make whatever the AG is recommending at this point to be binding in a way, and to be respected by departments. Because in most cases, departments do not implement what he says. And when he comes back, he finds the very same situation, and then he has to apply the rule of qualifying the department or a disclaimer. But I do not understand why, as a committee, we do not have a way of protecting the AG in that power thing. I don't know how to define it, but there should be something. He's a Chapter 9. I don't understand why he doesn't have some powers, if we can be assisted there. Thanks.
Sorry, I must also second Honourable Carter's request. The presentation needs to be in some form of a summary or writing, because I'm not sure if I misunderstood what he was saying, but for instance, an employee cannot be the auditor of the Auditor General, and the Act specifically says that, but I don't know if I thought you said something different to that. So I'm not sure. The surplus is from my understanding, the Auditor General charges its auditees for audits, and it has a budget of expenses. So if it has a surplus, it just means it made a profit for the year. It didn't spend anything. No SMEs haven't been paid. But it does need a surplus and does need working capital, because the auditees are known not to pay. I think what the researcher was trying to say was that surplus is used to pay smaller supplies, etc., going forward. But it would be easier if it's in writing, we can understand exactly what's been said or recommended. And then the third thing about the powers of the Auditor General, we must also bear in mind that the auditor's role is not to make decisions. He's only got one function, that is to say, these statements fairly represent the financial position, etc., and these are our findings. It is then actually up to various other persons, either the accounting officer, for instance, or the department that entity reports to, the director general or the minister, to take further actions. And I think what they're asking for us earlier today is, what happens when those actions aren't taken? Then we want to be able to do it. And secondly, what happens when we just have suspicions about something's not right and we want someone to investigate it further? So I think they've got enough powers. The reality is, you know, if they were to actually execute and force people to do things, then they would be, you know, transgressing their role. Their job is just to be an independent reviewer of stuff, and that's why they're Chapter 9, from the point of view to ensure their independence, that a minister can't tell them you must issue a clear report, for instance, or a DG or something like that. And that's why they've got to be independent, so that they don't rely on the Treasury to give them money, etc. That's why they're Chapter 9, not for the power side so much, but purely that their recommendations can be given freely without any interference from outside parties. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chair. Sorry. I support the proposal of the AG to submit his auditing reports. Why I'm saying this, Chair,
We are sitting with problems specifically in municipalities with disclaimers, and if the Auditor General can explain to us or in his findings inform or help this municipalities to come out of their disclaimers, or if he can assist us as the committee on how he get to his findings. In particular, we are the presenters of our parties and of our communities. We have been faced with these problems on a local level and provincial level. So it will be proper if he can submit his auditing reports to us. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. On the issue of the Auditor General also being a Chapter 9, I think we should get time to go and read on our own and come back to us. Because what I heard him saying is that in the Act that is governing the Public Protector, it's written in the Act, remedial actions. But in the Audit Act, it is not written. That is the difference. So if we can just read maybe on our own and discuss about it next time. But also I would like to support what Honorable Carter said at the beginning, that when we deliberate, Mr. Jenkins, it would be advisable if he is with us. We usually do that in appropriation. The question that if people do not abide by his recommendation, you know, I look at the Auditor General as a support to us as committees. He does his work, and committees must use that information to hold the executive to account. It is our business as committees to hold the business. It's not the duty of the Auditor General.
Thank you, Chairperson. I fully align myself also with the fact that somehow the AG's office should also be empowered in terms of executing their duties. But I also want to recommend or to come up with a view that the report that is brought by the researcher is very enlightening. It's really identifying some areas where there are anomalies, where there are misnomers and all those things. But I think maybe in future it will assist if a report then identify all those things, and then there are specific recommendations that the committee should look at, rather than just become a report that just identify the problems but doesn't identify possible proposals to address those problems. I think it will assist, so that we'll then zoom to those recommendations as well. Chair, also, I think when we talk about also empowerment of the Office of the AGs, I think it will assist us maybe in the next meetings as a committee, that we get a report on the state of the department of the AG in terms of the human resource capacity. What are the needs in terms of the human resource capacity, and what are the needs in terms of the tools of trade that they need for them to be effective, you know, because I think we were dealing with amendments and all those things, but we must also know what are the requirements
that the AG's office need in terms of for them to be able to execute the task that we expect them to do. And I think that report will help us. And then if it can come up also with recommendations as well, I think it will assist, Chair. That will be my input.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think we can have legislations and legislations year after year, but if we do not implement or take those legislations seriously, we're going to have a problem. These talk shows that you're talking about, I think you spoke to them, Chairperson, earlier on that we don't have a political will. Because I think if we try as members of parliament to be as objective as possible, not only in AG's committee, SCOAC and SCOPA and appropriations, but other committees as well, I think we'll have a problem. I think what I want to suggest is that we should find a way, because your document was good. I agree with most of the things that you said in the document. But the overview is that we have policies, we have regulations, we have legislations. All of them are good, but we do not implement. I think we should find a way, Chairperson, of finding, having joint committees where we resolve issues that we have. I think in other meetings that we had, I think it was in Pretoria, Chairperson, we had agreed with the AG, or at least that's what he said to him. Do you think that? iPad, can it make that noise as well? Okay. We've said that we want the performance audits or audits from the Auditor General be translated to service delivery. And we have not reached that stage yet. Maybe if we could pronounce ourselves as far as that is concerned. And I agree that maybe after going through that report of yours, together with the legal report that we're going to have, we'll find a way of paving things together. But we need to make sure that we bridge the gaps, Chapter 4. Thanks.
Before I come to you, Honorable Gordy, can we go to Carter, and then you can give us an external overview, and we'll try and answer some of these questions, or at least start the way forward, because all of us must answer these questions. Carter, you indicated you wanted to speak.
Thank you, Chair. I didn't want to be cheeky and take too much time early on, but there's a couple of points that I think was important that, you know, I thought someone else would have raised. Okay, firstly, you made a proposal to say that we've got to decide whether we continue doing it quarterly or whether we have more meetings. Chair, I would actually make the proposal that for now we leave it at quarterly, and when we have meetings like, for example, legislation, it will be additional meetings that we will call, as well as if we are going to receive the audit outcomes of audits, okay, that those be additional meetings. So I think but just for the normal meetings to leave it at quarterly and then have others additional. Because one of the things is that it is actually a concern and should be a big concern to us as well as to SCOPA, that if we look at what the AG is doing currently, we're looking at your annual financial statements, okay, as well as the performance plans, but not trying to play any politics here, because I don't think it's time for politics, it's people's lives. We would not have had, if the system worked, we would not ever have seen this, you know, if we take it, SASSA was established to actually physically do the payments. But if it was picked up by the AG 5-6 years ago, we would not have had the problem we had now. So we've got to look how we can get it to work so that they can actually pick up those problems. I want to give another example. As right currently now, if we look at the Department of Health, you know, the Department of Health is spending their budget, and they've got their targets, but they're not reaching those targets. KZN and the Free State, oncology departments need to be moved to other provinces because they don't, just don't have the equipment, they don't have oncologists, they've got none of that. So somehow we've got to get the performance, the monitoring and assessment of a performance. We need to get more teeth into it, if I can put it that way. Then, Chair, just a last thing is, I know that I sound like a gramophone on this issue, but I am still of a view. If the AG provides us with a findings, a combined findings register, that would also help SCOPA and the rest of the departments not to make the same mistakes. Thank you.
Well, thanks, comrade. I sincerely would have loved to have been here right from the beginning, because the issue at hand is indeed of interest to us as well. But of course, we had our committee meeting, to which we accepted the three of you's absence. Well, as you said, Comrade Chair, we in the Public Accounts Committee are the primary users of the work that comes from the Auditor General. And the work that you do to oversee or look after that office has a direct impact on the quality of what we get from, you know, from that office. So when you're discussing an issue around how to enhance the role, the functioning, or the powers of the Auditor General, it is indeed an issue of interest to us, because the repetitive reports that come out of that office come to us. So we think that in principle we support that process, the process that you are engaging in. But we also do believe that what we have witnessed in the last 2 years, comrade, is that there are instances where some departments are actually pushing back against the Auditor General, resisting cooperating with the Auditor General when they are being audited. Testing the waters, how far can they push? We've had instances where in one province departments were threatening to go to court. And we had rumors, you know, when we were at Chisanyama, that there was a department that called its entities and took a decision that they are going to challenge every finding of the Auditor General. And that led last year to some delays in the reports of that particular department that I'm not going to name. So, talking about enhancing that office, I think comes timely at a time when there is some element of trying to create space to do wrong in relation to financial management. So, two things from me. One, Comrade Chair, and I was still going to talk to you to say my view is that when the executive come to tell us about how they are distributing money amongst departments in February, it's a huge fanfare. The whole country come to a standstill. But when we are told how that money has been used, it's almost a non-event. And I think we need to say, when the Auditor General presents his general report, how does Parliament make that a national fanfare and bring the country to a stop to listen? And that is the issue I wanted us to talk to say, how do we engage the presiding officers, that depending on the rules, how do we get the Auditor General, maybe have a joint sitting, to come and say, well, this is how the monies were distributed, this is how the monies were used. Because as a country in a in an economy that is now in recession or that is not growing as much as we want, the first thing you want to do is to be able to account for every cent that you have. I would imagine that that is where the greatest interest will be. How is this money being used? In a way that will put the Auditor General right up there, with the Chapter 9 institution, just like public protest, just like any other. Secondly, it is around, let's look at the legislative framework. Because, you see, what the Auditor General is doing now, it is just but one choice out of possibly three. I was looking at this document here, where you have different systems. This is not a God-given system that we're having. It is just but one out of many. But equally, we can create our own system that responds to our needs as a country. You know, how do we position the Auditor General to be able to respond to the challenges that we have? And the challenges that we have is that year in and year out, the Auditor General makes findings, present them to oversight, and in SCOPA we go through those things, we make recommendations, but the reports come back the same way. Now, as you are aware, Comrade Chair, last year in the committee we took a decision that we want Parliament to become the center in the fight for good governance, and that will seek to bring the capacities and knowledge of all actors, all state institutions and even civil society organizations to rally behind SCOPA and provide us with the information that they have so that we can use it in the fight for good governance. And one of these entities is the Anti-Corruption Task Team. In our last engagement with them, interestingly, they were proposing that they think it does not make sense that the Auditor General is not part of the Anti-Corruption Task Team, because the wrong findings and the quantification of the amounts of monies that are used without following processes is in the hands of the AG. If you look at that amount and you look at the amount of monies that is being investigated by law enforcement, it's so little compared to what the AG has reported, because there's no referral system by which what the AG finds its way into law enforcement or any other body that can, you know, investigate, make findings, and then action is taken. And we have in principle encouraged that, agreed with that, but the principle of a referral system, what we need to bridge, a bridge between oversight and law enforcement. We get the issues from the AG, but how then do we take them to those who can investigate them further? In terms of your traditional oversight, there is no bridge, because we rely on the accounting officers to do it. But those are the same people who are guilty of the same issues, so they will sit on them. So I think finding that bridge that enables oversight and the Auditor General to... And just this morning, in one of the resolutions that we took, there is a recommendation that seeks to suggest that, for example, if you have irregular expenditure, how do we make it mandatory that a department should investigate those? They get their report end of July. By the end of the financial year, in March the following year, they must have investigated all the irregular expenditures and taken action. And the reports of all these investigations must be sent to the AG, must be sent to National Treasury, must be sent to SCOPA, must be sent to the Anti-Corruption Task Team, and that the Auditor General must be able to report on whether or not a department has investigated its irregular expenditure or not, and that be a finding that must lead to consequences. So, but that is just but one suggestion. I think there is much more that can be done. If it is legislation that must be tweaked, so be it. Because what we want is not to have repeat findings all the time. Otherwise, it makes nonsense of whatever we call auditing. It's nothing. So that is the challenge that we have. But we also have to appreciate that oversight is an evolving process. It's not static. So as we meet challenges, then we must find solutions to those challenges so that we're able to move forward. So I'm saying, therefore, Comrade Chair, that from our perspective as COPA, that's why I'm here, because I have an interest in this element. And I think from our side, we'll give whatever assistance is necessary to ensure that we're able to move forward. Thank you, Comrade.
Nyaksola wena Godi, because everything you said, and us members here, we've actually covered it. We are in agreement. We're on the same page. The referrals, all those things. So we've asked the AG to go back in terms of his amendments or his first bite of it with all those suggestions that you have just alluded to. He's going to give us a report towards the end of July, or when we come back from recess, and we will call him to talk to that report towards the end of August. I think we will call SCOPA so that when we tie up what we think he needs to do to improve, it's not in a silo from what you think. So I think we will do that. But it ties up. So Cindy, if you can ensure that it's somehow a joint meeting that we will just have, because he'll come and report on our initial things. And of course, your point that you make ties up with what Honourable Carter was talking about a more constructive role in terms of when he presents his general report. That it's not the AG and maybe Frolic or Smith somewhere. It maybe should be something that we initiate here. So we'll take that on board. We will take that on board so that we elevate the work of the AG, or certainly the findings of the AG. And then, of course, other members that we're talking about, including Mentor and them, by September, we'll answer all these questions that you're talking about, because we do have the AG give us his annual report, his annual report, where he talks about his staff shortages, his staff trainings, his retention, the surplus, and all those type of things. It's just that we're in the middle of it. But that does come. How does the surplus come about? And it comes to us to ask us the question, Honorable Mentor, for instance. I've made a 10 rand profit, surplus, whatever. Can I use it? And we ask him, what are you going to use it for? Because if he can't convince us, then he must give it to the revenue fund. So all those things are actually done. And I think it's September when he comes and presents his annual report to us. And of course, then I think what members are saying, researcher, is that can we come up with some sort of a working document, not regurgitating, as members are saying, what we've got, just the four or five or six, in other words, our Bible. What is it that we should always look out for? What is it that we should always ensure doesn't slip between the cracks from our side? I mean, all these other matters about whether the Auditor General, external auditors must or may, those are administrative things that we can fix up by changing the word must or may. But there are certain things that we think, like the usage of the surplus, like his lifting of his profile, like being the disciples of, and I'm saying it, Honorable Gordy, because we raised it also, I don't think it's the AG's fault that there is recurring irregular expenditure. The PFMA is very clear. It is us that are not doing our job. And I'm not sure, Honorable Carter, when you said that his annual reports must come to us, you must be careful what you wish for, ma'am. And I'm saying that because Gordy and others will tell you. The AG provides in excess of, I don't know how many, 3,000 reports or whatever. So if we said, let's look at the annual report, I think it will suffice, because it gives us a general overview around municipalities, province, and so on. But if we want all his audit reports, first of all, Gordy and them deal with it generally. we will just have it to read, but maybe the annual report, I agree with you. When he comes and presents, let's find a way of telling South Africans that you gave me 10 rand, I've wasted 7 of that 10 rand from an independent point of view. So we can do that. I'm not sure, Honorable Researcher, if there is any other matter that I didn't try to cover, other than to say we are meeting again in August. Before I close, I'll come back to you. We're meeting again in August. We will, and AG is going to come with his recommendations, as we've discussed. We can also come with our own one to empower us to ask more deepening questions. SCOPA will also be here, also to ensure that the AG is responding to some of theirs, so that when we go back, we can say to AG, there's Kombandlela. Because that's our role, to say, AG, this is, without necessarily getting into his business, this is how, as politicians, we think you must service us. So we'll be able to do that at the end of August. But we will make those documents available, Honorable Gordy, even to members of SCOPA, in terms of his draft too. And we can jointly plan for that meeting of the end of August, in terms of shaping the new direction. Mamshop.
Thank you, Chairperson. I just want to very humbly request, Chairperson, in the spirit of cooperative oversight as committees, that yourself and Honorable Gordy, in your chairpersons, you have a committee as chairpersons, just make some notes for the other chairpersons, because I hear this thing of a big fanfare for reporting back on how monies were spent. You know how auditors work. They don't do everything. There is what in auditing we call random sampling. So they don't check everything. So, but the portfolio committees, when departments come to them, they should insist on seeing the internal audit reports, because those ones are dedicated to the department, and you can pick up a lot of things before things go haywire. So that is just what I wanted to say, Chairperson, because I'm just putting my other side of it, good, that we have got this thing of attracting what do you call it, foreign investment. If you have a meeting, a fanfare like that, where the Auditor General will come and say, now 40 billion has gone down the drain, outsiders start thinking, where is Parliament? Because it should not happen, because I believe, as I'm sitting here, that this thing is not because government is working. It's because Parliament is not effective. It's not. We have to revisit the way we do oversight. For instance, we spend a lot of time sitting in committees here. A lot of things are going haywire. People tell us there's a hospital, we just believe, and it's not Sunday. Why are we not doing a lot of oversight outside? Our committee experimented it just now. We went to Khayelitsha. We had people hewing as if they are going to vote, coming with problems, which you cannot know sitting here. Thank you, Chair.
All right. Honorable members, we will try and craft, on the lines of we're talking about. We'll meet quarterly outside of these special meetings. For whatever we require to do in terms of capacity. We will obviously have to incorporate now the amendment of the bill, and then whatever that takes, whether it's public hearings or everything members have spoken about. But we'll try and come with a program. But principally, we'll meet quarterly, other than whatever is required statutory from your side, sir. And do those type of things. Our next meeting will be when we come back from recess. We will give you dates. Cindy's indicating that we might have to, when we motivate for these amendments, have a more detailed document with legal advisors and that type of thing. So if it means that we must meet with Jenkins and others to draft up the terms of reference and or whatever, the objects of the Act, we will do that. But short of that, I'm saying in terms of the real milestones, we will get the AG's report, the AG's draft too. We will deliberate on them towards the end of August, and we will hope to take a strengthened or the amendments to the House by the end of September, whether it's us, whether it's an ad hoc committee, whether it's somebody else. But those are the milestones that we'll place for now, and then include the annual report sometime in September. To do that. Honourable members, thank you very much. Unless some members want to add something else, we will work on that premise and take it from there. Is that acceptable? If that is acceptable, somebody indicated to me this, then this lunch at 1 o'clock? Here. Old Assembly. Oh. This building downstairs. Where's the dining hall? Yeah, no, yes. V8 or whatever it is. No, the dining hall, yes. There's lunch there for those that want to have lunch. And then we will communicate with you in terms of the meeting dates and so on. Thank you very much. The meeting is adjourned. Thank you very much, honorable members.
I'm going there tonight, so I know. No box, man. Is there no box? Listen, let me go to the office quickly.
Okay, short on me.
No, yeah, it's not so short. It's almost too fine. Yeah, no, I think it's good.
Thank you.